episode number 24 of the Inside Running Podcast. Thanks for joining us. We're coming out early today because we think there's some stuff worth talking about that is pretty current and relevant to today's events at the Gold Coast. Commonwealth Games, no sponsors, no script, old school Road to Berlin kind of style. We're just going to see where this takes us today. And thanks for joining us and thanks for downloading the show. As always, good evening, Bradley and Julian.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining me. We've been banging messages back and forth the last 10 minutes, half an hour, and we decided that it's probably best to record this on a Sunday night while everything is very fresh. And I am thankful because you guys have both had very big days as well.
Yeah, big going on.
Big going on. We're still going to do our weekly recap, so we'll start off with that, and you guys can actually explain what you've done today, because I think that's important so the listeners know that, we're pretty tired tonight and pretty emotional, and, we're kind of really gone out of our way to try to get this out very current time. So, Brad, do you want to kick us off?
Yep, no worries. So, Monday, just two runs, 45 minutes in the morning, 35 and some hills in the arvo, so just 10-second hills. My session for Tuesday was 5 2-minute efforts and 5 1-minute efforts, all off a minute recovery. Average 255 kilometre pace for the 2-minuters and 248 pace for the 1-minuters. So reasonably happy with that. Wednesday was 23k at 4:11s. A little bit tired because I only had sort of just over 12 hours recovery from that Tuesday afternoon session. Thursday, just over an hour in the morning at 4:16s and 35 minutes in the afternoon. Then on Friday, I was pretty tired come Thursday, and I was having an hour in whether I'd do my session Friday morning or do it after school, and I decided to do it after school even though I knew that there was a chance of a thunderstorm. And the session was 12K through Mulligans of basically running the hills really hard and just cruising everything else. And I got about 9K into it and this massive storm hit. And like I've run through some storms before, but this one I was genuinely scared. We had 90K an hour winds and, running through the bush with trees. I was just like, man, I hope I get out of this alive. So I ended up averaging sort of 3:37 for that 12K. Saturday was just an hour in the morning and 7K in the afternoon. Had a massage last night, which was good. Helps keep me in one piece. And then this morning was Canberra Marathon. So I had a mate down from Sydney for it. So I was a pretty early start. I was up about 4:30. Race started at 6:25. Plan was to pace at sort of 2:55. We'll run 2:55 marathon pace with Sean Crichton, who was pacing a mate, but his mate pulled the pin at 10K. So then I pretty much ran 17K at sort of 2:55 marathon pace, and then the last 17K was probably 3:45 kilometre pace. So we got sort of rolling towards the end. So I did just under 34K in 2 hours 15, and it was pretty horrible day. It was pretty windy and quite exposed in areas. Week was good. It was my first 100-mile week since the marathon, 161K. So all good. That's my week.
Sorry, I'm not laughing at your week. I'm laughing at Julian trying to sort that cat out at his end.
Yeah.
Dumb cat.
Couldn't help yourself. Got 3:45 rolling in that pacing job that didn't turn into a pacing job.
No, it was more Sean, because Sean was pacing a mate, and then I was actually in front of Sean at that point, like up until 17K, because I just was running 2:55 pace, but he went back to his mate, who was obviously struggling, and then Sean must have dropped a couple of really quick kilometres to sort of get close to me again around 17K, and I said, what are you going to do now? He goes, I'll just keep rolling. And so I was pretty much then just a windbreak for him for the next 17K until I pulled off the course, and he kept going and ran 2:47.
How's that, Julian? You're just fun runner. You're out there having a crack at Canberra Marathon, and then Sean would be about number 7 or 8 of all time, and number 71 of all time just go stroll and pass on their Sunday long run.
Yeah, it's the company he keeps, isn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. Be a pinch yourself moment, I reckon.
Yeah, but it was good. Sort of broke something different anyway, doing a long run out on a marathon course.
Sign any autographs, Brad, to any listeners?
Nah, I was in and out pretty quick.
No, they're regular for you.
No, yeah.
No one said hello from the. No one recognised you from the podcast at all.
There was one guy I ran with, probably about 4K in. I had a quick chat with him. He was hoping for 2:59, I think. So I'm not sure how he ended up, but that was it basically. Yep.
Yeah,
so
right. That's good.
Yeah.
Good. We might we'll get some news on those boys later on. Julian, take us through your week.
My week, Monday, very standard. So got out, did some hill sprints for once. So I'm pretty proud of myself for doing that. On the Tuesday morning, had a workout, just a standard Moose Fartlek, 2 minutes hard, 1 minute sort of floats. Seven, got a question about why it was seven. Well, the lake is 6K, so I kind of guessed it'd be around 20 minutes or so for it, maybe 19. And I got through 21, it's a 21 minute session, so run through the lake and then add on a little bit. Actually quite slow compared to what I've done in the past. I think I went through the lake in maybe like 1907 or something. And then I checked back after this workout, I kind of had a look and thought, oh geez, last year I ran 1837 for the lake on this same workout. So kind of a little bit of a downer after seeing that. In the afternoon, was going to run, but just got flogged at work. And by the time I was going to leave the store, it was like pitch black and I was hungry and it just wasn't going to happen for me. So had an afternoon off due to being a working class man. Wednesday, tried to make up a few extra Ks because of the missed Tuesday night. So I actually did a bit long run, which I don't normally do. I felt really good on it, enjoyed it, and listened to an interview with Steve Jones, who is proper badass from back in the day. Loved that interview. And by the time I finished, I thought, oh, geez, that really barely even knew I was running then. Thursday, standard run. Friday, did a tempo workout. So I did 10-mile tempo, 16K officially, croaker. But
yeah.
it's 10 miles, 16.1.
Yeah, 16.09.
Oh, yeah, all right. Well, I didn't do that. I did 16K. And I kind of went out, like, this is a workout I was a bit nervous for before the start because it beats you up. Like, it's a long workout, 51 minutes of kind of steady state running. And I used to do these and get my ass kicked like every single time. I could never hold even when I was trying to run 220 and I was doing some killer long runs. Like one program I ran, I think it was a 40K long run. I averaged 327s or something. And then I couldn't even do my 10-mile tempo at 320s during that program. It still used to beat me up. So I'm always nervous for this. I had a good one before Berlin, which sort of gave me confidence. And then in this one, I went out a bit slower with the goal to not blow up and then just kind of felt like it was pretty steady and easy. And I thought, oh, by the time I finished, I was rolling. So I ran 51:51 and still felt like it was pretty under control. And so I was happy with that. Went up a few hills in the park. It was windy. So it was a good workout. Saturday. It's Friday night. I had to go down to Anglesey because my sister was over at a birthday party. So I drove like 90 minutes down after work, went to the party, woke up. Employee couldn't make it in to open the store, so I had to cut my run short. So driving back early, only got a shorter run in. Got a run in the Arvo though after work, which was good. Then drove down to Warrnambool because the Warrnambool Athletics Club put on they had a race today, but they also had a bit of a party or a viewing for the marathon. Caught up with Brady's coach, Richard, which is always fun. Good bloke. Got a lot of knowledge. Don't know why it doesn't get passed along, but
That's why I need him on the team.
Yeah, good fella. Virginia Maloney's from down there, so we were there to kind of celebrate Gin and watch the race, and yeah, it was a good day. Had a sort of did a few sales, which was nice. Met a lot of people, excellent. Decided to do my long run down there, but the weather was just absolutely foul. So drove back 2 hours. Well, it's about two to two and a half hours. Drove back and got dropped off on the rail trail out of town, which was not bad. It was sort of crosswind, not quite a tailwind, but a lot better than it could have been. And just ran steady today. So ran 40K, averaged 3:52. Pace was never an issue. It was always feeling pretty comfy. I just get bored on my own on long runs. That's why I do them a bit faster. Just wanted to be over. I listened to a couple of podcasts, listened to Thomas DeCando interview, and also Dave Costello. I Dave and I have a lot of similar thoughts. I like Dave.
We actually need to get Dave on this show because we've got a few listener questions banked up about strength and conditioning stuff. They're kind of all similar. We actually need an expert instead of us just banging on about random stuff that we kind of know.
Well, I listen to his podcast, so I'm pretty much an expert.
Yeah, yeah. He's very knowledgeable, very, like, generous with his time and knowledge as well. Like, that stuff you'd pay big money to kind of hear, I reckon.
$120 an hour, apparently, PT.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's good. He's good. Dave, you're listening to this. We're going to give you a call.
Yeah, yeah. No, so that was my week. 181. Missed a couple of runs, a couple of short, just life getting in the way of professional running.
I gather that because you were a bit short on the old Strava comments on Friday. Brad, did you notice that? Jeez, I just put a bit of a joke in there and just got cut down. Like, he just took me down real quick.
What was your joke? What was your joke though? Was it funny?
Because he loves like referencing this like Chico State University, which I think if you've heard that interview with him, he kind of just rang up and just went over there. I don't think they even wanted him over there in the first place, but that's a whole different story.
They had no idea who I was.
Yeah, just rocked up.
Up on the train, knocked on the door, and said, "I'm here."
So you'll notice sometime when he's up and about, he'll reference like, "Yeah, that's the best session I've done since I was at Chico State University," like talking like he's on a big dog scholarship or something. So I just put that in the comments.
You wait till I get the kit out and I wear the kit. Jeez.
So I was just sitting around like minding my own business and I thought, I'll just bang a comment out here and just said, he loves this reference and then tagged you in it. And then it was the next minute was like, how long did you drive to like do your run today? And I'm like, I ran from your front door. Oh, surprised you didn't strive for that one. And like, just like nothing to do with my original comment, but it was just like, bang, how can I cut this guy down? I'm going to do it.
And I did it.
Yeah, just
remember, I always had that in my back pocket, the ability to cut you down. I was a high school bully, and I can be an adult post-high school bully.
Actually, funny you said that, because I bumped into some people at Parkrun this week, and they said that I hadn't seen these people before, and they said they'd come across you, and they listened to the podcast, and they said something like, he's actually not bad in person compared to what he sounds like on the podcast and his comments on Strava. Like, we were expecting this, like, real, like, bit of a kind of loose unit, but he's, a bit different in person.
Nah, what do you mean? This is all fun. I've put a character on for this podcast.
I said the same
moose.
Thing. Yeah, the moose. Yeah. Very good, very good. Good week for me. I trained like a Ballaradian. Is that what you guys are called down there? Yeah, I had a good week. 16K on Monday. I was still on school holiday, so I was training like a full-time athlete, which was good. 8K Tuesday morning. Went over Shepparton on Tuesday afternoon to run on their beautifully new athletics track, which does my head in because I think the runners club over there are paying like $80 an hour to hire. So I'm a bit annoyed about that because the Runners Club are great over there. They had about 35 people on there. Chris Armstrong was running their session, and, they were doing some 300s. I did 5x400 with 200-meter float. So Richard likes to give me this one before I progress to the full Deeks quarters in a couple of weeks' time. Wore the 4%ers for the first time on an athletics track and absolutely loved it. Felt like I was just floating 68s and, kind of worked the last one home a bit and hit a 62 for the last 400. Most of the floats were in about 39.40 and ended up covering the 3K for that session in 8:52, and yeah, felt really comfortable. Chucked the heart rate monitor on after that and did just a 15-minute threshold on a few soccer ovals on the grass, which was good, and averaged 3:19, hit about 4.5K, warmed down, drove home. Wednesday, 90 minutes, nice and easy. It was a bit slower this week, only hit 19.5K. Thursday, drove to Bendigo. This was a big trip. It took me about 90 minutes to get out the other side of Bendigo to do this hilly tempo, a few road works, and that annoyed me. And yeah, this kind of Richard's got this loop when he used to live in Bendigo. So it was 10K, about 192 metres elevation, average 330s, and the plan is to smash the hills and float the rest, which is easier said than done, because the hills just bang you up and you end up kind of floating probably faster than you are going up the hills, because you, it's just easier to kind of get rolling a bit. So I was happy with that. Didn't really know what was going to happen, because I haven't really done that one before. Just ran off a stopwatch. The heart rate data probably didn't mean much to me at that stage, because I didn't really know what I was kind of aiming for, and the pace I didn't really know either. So just went on a stopwatch and tried to do it the best I could. And that was pretty solid workout. I like that. I think it's going to make me pretty tough going forward. Want to get down there a bit more often and do it. Gym Thursday night, so that was a big day. And then a run after that. Easy jog Friday. My Fridays have been super easy. Just did 8K at 4:43 pace. And then Saturday, I was in charge of parkrun Saturday morning, so I didn't get out till about 10:40. And kind of similar to you, Julian, I had this longer tempo on the cards and I was dreading it a bit because I didn't really know how I was going to bounce back after those hills. But it was a bit of a mixed tempo. So it was 5K, this was the plan, 5K at 3:20 pace into 3K at 3:10 pace into 3K at 3:20 pace into 3K at 3:05 pace. So I guess I haven't asked Richard what the thinking was behind it. It's the first time I've done it, but I think it's kind of a mix of that marathon into half marathon pace, back to marathon pace, maybe into 10K pace, and hammering down rain and windy, and it wasn't fun, but the legs, they liked it. They rolled it pretty well and hit those splits probably a tiny bit quicker here and there, and was kind of really happy with the way the session rolled out, and ended up with 14K at 3:13 average, and the heart rate data was good, about 165 for that stuff. And then 32K easy this morning, Sunday morning, went out at 5 o'clock to try and get it done so I could watch some marathons at the Commonwealth Games on TV. Hit about 148 for the week, still just quality sessions and not too much junk around it, and feeling good, ready moving forward. I like that week.
Yeah, what, that was a good session. Go on.
What's going on with that long run? That would do my head in.
Oh, yeah. I come up with this great idea because I haven't done a long run by myself for ages. And because it was so dark at 5 o'clock, I came up with this ripping idea last night to entertain myself. I was going to try and run around every street in Moama. And I was like, I reckon I could probably do that in 32K. So I went up to the housing estate, which is like a K from my house, and kind of hit every court up there, and then went to another one, and then went to central Moama. And I got to about, 15K, and I was like, stuff this. It was light by then as well, so I just went on the trails. But I just kind of mixed it up and just had the iPod in, listening to music, and just rolling around. So that was that idea, Brad. Didn't hit every street. Nearly got them, though. It's a cool little map.
I would have pulled the pin after 6K by the looks of that, I reckon.
Yeah, it was nice. And the only thing I was a bit worried about, there was a lot of, because it was so early and I don't have a head torch, that a lot of that was just on hard surface as well. But so that was the whole idea about that. And it was kind of good being finished by 7:30. It was pretty rare that my Sunday long, you're done 32K by 7:30 in the morning. But that was nice. Still slow though. When you do those longer runs at 4:25 pace, you're kind of out there. That was 2:21 today. So you're kind of doing those long duration runs.
Yeah, I know about it.
Coming from the guy who did 40K. Right, yeah, boys. Running news. Comm Games. Start with a marathon. I reckon that's what the listeners want to hear first. That was this morning.
Oh, yeah.
So, Julian, you commentated it. Just maybe give us a bit of more context on this event you were at. So you were special comments, VIP, elite athlete extraordinaire.
I just missed all of that.
I was just saying you were at this event today and you were VIP commentating.
Oh, yeah.
Elite athlete extraordinaire. What was the story?
I have some thoughts on the marathon. Well, firstly, let's talk about how good Michael Charley was to win another gold medal. Let's talk about his Commonwealth Games career. He won silver first, right? Silver in Delhi?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gold in Glasgow? And then gold in the Gold Coast. Now, that is pretty hard to top for a marathon runner that competes against Kenyans at every and other African nations and other great nations at every Com Games. Like, that is one of the most consistent records you'll ever see in the marathon.
Yeah.
Maybe off the top of my head, I don't know, but it sounds like one of the greatest ever.
Yeah, you'd be hard, over that stretch of time as well. It'd be hard to beat.
Yeah. So
worst results are silver.
We need to acknowledge that was an amazing effort for a bloke that we don't see that much of. Like, he pops up every few years and just shocks us with how good he can be.
And to do that in your hometown, like, with that added pressure, like, he doesn't, you know, seem like an out there kind of, loves the media attention, likes, you know, that kind of, that spotlight on him, to then, you know, prepare properly and then be able to execute that race on your home soil is pretty amazing.
Yeah. So in the men's, like, Liam finished fifth, which was also a great run. The conditions looked very hot, like really taxing. There's no shade anywhere. It was I'm never running Gold Coast ever after watching that today. That is not a place that I would want to go and beat myself up over. It just looks like it's unrelenting, the sun. I get that they start the race early and we can have a talk about that, but still, to me, that looked brutal. Liam, fifth, great run, beat a lot of good runners, but didn't quite have it when the going got going. And, like, the race started to pop off when Callum Hawkins went to the front and started to push the pace, which a lot of people, like, you had the commentators going, oh, he's taking a risk, rah, rah. Well, in the end, yeah, maybe, given how hot it was. But that, like, for him, right, going through in around about 2:14, 2:15 pace, that was not taking a risk. That was well within what he is capable of.
Well, the first 5K was 2:21 pace. They went through the first 5K the same as what I went through when I ran 2:21 at Nobuyoka the other week. I said it to Carly when I was sitting there watching. Like, these guys, his heart rate would have been at about 145, I reckon, if that.
Yeah.
That's a jog for him. Yeah.
So,
But also think, if you look at the splits, I think what brought him undone was between 20 and 35K, he was running 2:10 marathon pace.
It's different, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And at the end of the day, you need to respect the distance and the conditions. And to try and, even though he's gone through 20K relatively comfortable, to try and run 2:10 pace, even for the last half, is, you know, obviously wasn't achievable.
Yeah, it wasn't. And, like, was he taking on enough fluids? That was a more dehydration sort of breakdown than anything else, maybe a depletion I don't fully know why that happened. It seemed to me like it was a heat stroke dehydration issue.
Here's one for you though, Julian. So if he's feeling that good at halfway and it's a championship race, why not just be a little bit more patient, a little bit more patient, a little bit more patient? Because at the end of the day, if he's the most comfortable with 5K to go, he's still going to run away from them.
Yeah, and that's probably, like, I think his patience maybe wasn't quite as good as what it could have been. Also, he's probably used to racing better Kenyans, to be honest.
Yeah, where that's true. He
doesn't have the confidence, like, because he gets blown away by those guys in the last 5-10K in big races, where he's like, oh, these guys are going to kill me, where really those guys
are
shit compared to who he's normally racing.
And surely he would have done his research, though. Like, he would have known that they weren't the top-tier Africans.
Yeah, I reckon he had a game plan and it probably didn't adjust well enough to how hot it was. He probably didn't go, you know what, today's steaming, I'm feeling pretty hot, like I probably need to adjust how far out I'm going to push from. Because I listened to an interview with him before the race and he's been on the course and he's sort of looking at the spots where he's going to attack, and he had this game plan before he went in and he executed it without realizing how bloody hot it is. And he was even saying, oh, there's some spots on the course where it's really exposed and it's going to be hot, so I need to, like, fucking put a hat on with ice and stuff like this. So maybe you just needed to back off
I can't remember who told me, but I remember somebody saying about the marathon that, especially in a championship race, if you're feeling good at 20K, just wait. Just be patient. Yeah. If you're feeling good at 25K, like, just wait. And then, you know, maybe the last 5K, then go for it. I just think it was, obviously just, as you said before, just probably wasn't patient enough considering the conditions. I have no doubt he probably, if he was more patient and just kept rolling in the pack, he probably would have run away with it.
I think he was the winner. He was the best athlete out there.
Well, for him to be here, like, he's probably given up a big payday at London, you know, fourth at World Champs, 10th at the Olympics, like, you know, all the other guys in that field are absolutely amazing, but he's probably the only one with a half marathon PB of 60 minutes dead, and in that kind of next kind of super elite top tier, and he was there to win it, like he said that in that Marathon Talk interview, and he bypassed those big city races to come here and is tough as nails. You watch the way he races. Like, he was here to absolutely dominate that and win it hands down.
Yeah, and I'll touch on this later, but I think part of it could be due to how the different countries or nations see the Com Games. And I reckon he's out there. I was thinking at like 25, 30K going, oh, he's going to finish this and go, oh, that was pretty shit. Like, I beat guys that aren't on my level. I wasted a marathon effort. I could have bloody made 50 grand at London Marathon or something like that. Mm. I was thinking that at 30K. Now he's probably thinking the same thing right now, except, shit, I didn't even finish that one. I didn't get a medal. I've still fucked up London Marathon, and I got no money from it. It wasn't a lot of upside for him running Com Games, except for the Patriot kind of, I like my country, I want to win a Com Games medal.
Hmm. Yeah, I did see someone tweet something like, Hawkins' threshold looks like it's going really well here or something like that. Like, he just looked so comfortable. He was blowing him out of the water, put a minute on him real quick, and he just looked like he was, just a cut above the rest.
And he went down, and when he went down, I could not believe it. Like, I saw him step in the gutter, and he kind of had to sort of almost push himself off the fence at the start. And I'm like, what has happened? Is he tripped? Is he his shoes fault? Like, what is he was? He didn't slow down. He went from running probably 3:10 pace to on the ground. A lot of blokes who aren't. No, I'm going to go back. I'm going to say this is an example of toughness. When you can push past your body telling you to self-preserve. And that involves slowing down. And he just pushes straight through it. He doesn't listen to the body saying, if you don't slow down, mate, you're going to end up on the ground.
Do you reckon he had those signs, O'Julian, or do you reckon it just went from like just 0 to 10 real? Like, I'm sure he was fatiguing, but it looked like he was, 6, 7 out of 10 discomfort to like 10 out of 10, you're falling over. Like, it didn't seem to gradually happen.
I know, but most of us, I think there's a different threshold for how we feel those early signs.
Yeah.
And he feels them and goes, oh, it's hard. I like this. I'm going to keep pushing. Yeah. Whereas a lot of us might go, oh, it's hard. This is a sign I need to slow down.
What I found weird was when they obviously had footage of something else, and then they came to him. This was just before he fell over the first time, and he looked like he was absolutely flying. Like, he wasn't going straight. Like, he was starting to sort of get closer to the gutter, but it was almost like he'd lost control of, I think it was maybe slightly downhill. It was almost like he'd lost control of his body, but he had this momentum and he was absolutely flying, and then he sort of hit the gutter.
Yeah, well, he was running so close to the gutter. Like, he was off the borderline and, like, nearly taking out people on the side.
But what I found, like, sort of impressive was the fact that he was able to get up and probably run another 800 metres and not look that bad. Like, I reckon if he could have actually held that for 2K, he probably would have won. Like, who does that? Who can actually fall down and then still get up and move the way he was for that 800 metres?
He's as tough as nails. Yeah.
So he goes down before he takes the right-hand turn onto the bridge, and then he gets back. Like, he was lucky that first time he went down, because he landed right on a kind of grassy nature strip, kind of did a bit of a roll, got himself back up, and then he went to go over and he kind of fell onto a man, and he kind of just nudged off him and then looked like he got the momentum going again. So this is still the first stage. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, actually, to just go off, like, people are messaging me 2 minutes beforehand with, like, money bag emojis. Like, you were right. You told us to put money on this guy on the podcast. Da, da, da. I'm, like, punching the air, like, we're cashing in here. I'm going to put $10 on him at $18. And then all of a sudden I'm getting all these other messages, like, exclamation marks and people swearing and, like, people just, like, shocked. And then he seemed to just, like, come. And I'm thinking, there's no way he's going to. I knew that course because Brad and I ran it last year. There's no way he's going to get to the top of that bridge. Like, that's a bit of a, just slowly leans up. But if you're cooked like that and already hit the deck, I was thinking there's no way he's going to get to the top of that. But he just soldiered on. And, yeah, he didn't look great, Brad, but he looked like he could possibly hold that for 2 more K.
And then once he headbutted the railing.
Well, once it almost started going down, like, and then he went over the 40K timing mat and it was like, just lights out.
Yeah. Let's talk about that now.
Yeah.
So I'll explain how I was watching, because how I was watching has differed. My thoughts on it have differed pretty dramatically since I was watching and full of emotion, now that I stood back and had a bit of a thought about it. And so I'm watching, I guess, to explain the situation. I'm sure everyone's seen it, but he went down in front of an elderly couple who were watching. They were kind of shocked to see it happen. Bunch of people sort of crowded round. He was inebriated, basically. He couldn't stand up. He couldn't walk. He didn't. I would estimate or sort of submit that he didn't actually know where he really was at that time, because he was that far gone, like, not just mentally but physically. He was all over, and it was very distressing watching someone in that state, because you knew that he was, like, to me, that there's not much scarier to watch, because it's a sport we know, and we know how we have control of our body, and he did not have control over his body. So I was watching with all the rest of the people in the room. Like, there were kids there that were almost, like, that were upset. They didn't know, understand what was happening. And the people started to crowd around him from the barrier. So they were separated with the barriers. He was tangled in the barrier. His knees were beneath him in, like, angles that you would never expect for knees to be in. And there was a rush of crowd. There was people. There was one lady in particular. She had, like, a light blue bib on with 7 on the back. It looked like she was some kind of there in an official capacity. And she was filming or taking photos. And she would take a photo. Then she would check her photo. She would run to a different angle, take a photo. And it was probably one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen. And there were people there shocked, did not know what to do. They were separated by a pretty solid barrier, so there was no just, like, walk out and help him. But they were standing there looking very concerned. But there were people there taking photos, and there was we can't lump the spectators into one group, because I think there were two distinct type of people there. There was the really shit people who were making a spectacle of it, who didn't give a shit about him, and then there were spectators there watching who thought, this guy's in trouble, I don't really know what to do. I was yelling at the people, like, I was swearing in front of kids, like, looking at this girl taking photos, just so angry at it. And so after he went down, I would have said probably, well, it was at least it was at least 2 minutes from when he went down until someone got there. And then when the girl got there, she pretty much just stood looking at him on the ground without, it looked like she was super confused as to what she was supposed to do. She didn't rip, she looked, to me, she looked like she didn't have any training, that she was radioing for someone else to come because she didn't know what to do, because she wasn't doing a single thing while the cameras were on. She was standing there looking at him, laying sprawled on the ground. That was my take on it. And then the next time we kind of saw them, he was in an ambulance. The other thing I think to note was Michael Shalley. They did film him from behind as he ran past, and you could kind of see Callum on the fence. A few people have sort of mentioned, oh, that's a bit rough just running past, not trying to stop. But in my mind, like, you're at the 40K mark of a marathon. Michael Shalley was absolutely spent. I don't think he realised what was happening, and there is no way you would expect someone like that to stop at the 40K mark of a marathon, because his body was shutting down on him. He couldn't offer help. There was nothing he could do in that situation. So, like, some people have mentioned that, and there's people mentioning stuff all the time, but to me, that one was a clear, no, Michael Shalley, there's nothing wrong with what he did. Yeah. I don't know whether your boys' views are the same or different.
Yeah, well, Shalley didn't have the vision that we had on the TV as well, so he didn't know that he fell at the 39.5K mark and got back up and then hit the deck again. Like, his ran past, and you guys know what it's like. I don't think you can probably make a comment on that unless you've ran a marathon and know what your body's going through at 40K in itself. Like, you're almost in survival mode as it is. This is a guy who's just moved into the gold medal position. He's cooked. Like, he looked terrible. Like, it wasn't like he was jogging past and kicking home and full of energy. So, yeah, it's very tough to make a decision at that moment. And, you know, I read a couple of pretty harsh criticisms that, you know, he would have been remembered more if he did stop and offer assistance more than if he has won the gold medal. I think that's rough, and probably coming from people who haven't run a marathon and know what the body feels like at that stage, maybe a, yeah, like that lady, I think the big thing was that medic who didn't seem to be doing much was there when he ran past. I think it would have been a different story if Hawkins was on the side of the road like he was 30 seconds earlier with no assistance, and then he ran past the same way. That would create a bit of a, yeah, different conversation. Brad?
But what assistance can, as you said, I think the key thing was that there was an official standing over Hawkins at the time that Shalley went past. So even if Shalley was thinking, you know, if he wasn't delirious from the race, he's like, well, he's in good hands because there's an official there. And how's Shalley going to help him? Shalley didn't have a drink bottle. Like, you know, how can you help a guy like that? And it's like, it's not Shelley's job to do that. You know, that's what they have medics for on the course. You know, that's their job.
Yeah, it's not, yeah, his job's to win the gold medal.
I found it really disturbing to watch, and I actually watched it hours after it happened, because I guess I was at Canberra Marathon and we taped it. So they did have a big screen at Canberra Marathon, but I didn't really want to know. So I actually turned off my phone, turned off everything, and then came home and watched it. So I would have been watching it at like 1:30 in the afternoon when it was all over and done with. And I'm still like just yelling at the TV going, get you some fucking help. Like, and it's, you know, it happened like 3 hours ago. And I've heard stories about he told them not to help him, which, you know, because then I guess his race, he'd be DQ'd if somebody helped him. But if I was a spectator there, I know, okay, if he's 50 metres from the finish line, you probably give him a bit of time to see if he can crawl, like I've seen some people do at like the end of an Ironman triathlon or something. But he's still 2 kilometres from home. He's not getting 2 kilometres. So if I was a spectator and I had it and I could help him, and I think the only way you could help him was to have something cool, like, you know, some water to cool him down or give him a drink, I think I would have almost had to run. Like, I don't think I could have just stood back. I would have actually just copped the abuse from whoever, because there's no way that guy was covering another 2 kilometres on his own.
Yeah, I was yelling at the TV, like, I'm like, jump the fence. Like, I don't get that worked up. And even, like, working with kids at school, I very rarely get angry. And I was swearing, and, like, Carly was getting upset and, like, starting to cry on the couch next to me. And I'm just like, just someone help him. Like, yeah. Oh, I was livid. Like, I was...
Like, I would have lived with the consequences of, you know, police arresting me or whatever for jumping on the course. Like, I just, yeah.
Well, this is a conversation.
So far from home.
But yeah, if the medics were there, none of this would have happened. Like, I rewatched it this afternoon before we recorded. Like, I didn't want to because it distressed me again rewatching it. But from the first time that he fell over, that was 4 minutes and 22 seconds after. So, sorry, that was the first time he hit the gutter, got wobbly at the 39K mark, until the lady with the bum bag arrived. That was, 4 minutes and 22. Now, we shouldn't be talking about spectators should have jumped in or Michael Shelley should have helped, because if you're in that lead car or you're a medic on the side of the road or whatever, if you see a guy go over, it shouldn't take you 4 minutes and 22 seconds to get the medical assist. They should have been next to him while he was going up that bridge, waiting for him to go down the first time. Because he would have just kept getting up and falling over. And all it would have taken is him to hit his head badly on that rail to bloody knock him unconscious. And then, you know what I mean? We would have been asking different questions. That's the duty of care, I think, really let people down. And I think, you know, Lee Troop called me out on a Twitter today. I said it was kind of embarrassing to watch that it took so long for that to happen, and yeah, I think they had to be better than that. I was disgusted that it took them so long to get there.
Yeah, that's a good point you make, that he had fallen at 39K, and at the point when he got back up and he managed to make that other, you know, another 800 metres or so, at that point you go, okay, you let him keep going because he's actually still moving and he was moving okay, but yeah, you should have had a paramedic pretty much like next to him.
This is the winner, yeah. It's not the guy who's come at 8th spot and, like, in no man's land. Like, every camera's on this guy. They've got all that live stream, all that information there. It's a winner of the Commonwealth Games at the 40K mark going over a bridge on a 29-degree day. Like, all the warning signs are there.
Yeah, and you just have somebody shadow him until he falls that second time at 40K, and then that's it, game over.
We had paramedics riding next to us when we were pacing at Gold Coast last year. Like, it's pretty common... Yeah, people on bikes, like the St. John's Ambulance. Like, I don't know where they all were.
Well, apparently they were every 500 metres, which puts them at any given point maximum 250 metres away from anything happening, which is pretty rare that you would have someone maybe in the dead middle, which means that there only should be 100 to 200 metres away, which is really... 30 seconds. Yet it took that long. And when she walked up, there's a photo, a great photo, a lot of the newspapers are using it, of Michael Shelley running past and the lady just standing there staring at Hawkins, who is like basically in distress on the ground, and she's just standing there staring at him. Like it. So, and there is an argument out there saying, I guess we have to address this, that people have... They're saying, oh, well, he attempted to wave them off. Now, and also that if he was helped, that he would be disqualified. So firstly, we'll have a discussion or I'll make a comment on it. If that is actually the case, then what should be done? So if that rule is true, then... there has to be a discretion used by a medical officer or by an official who are all there to say this bloke here is not in a state where he can accurately assess his well-being. He can't stand up. He can't even hold onto the railing. He's totally out of it. He can't say, no, don't help me. You need to help him. Like, what happens if he's passed out? Who makes the decision then? Like, he can't say, I want you to help me. That is, it's a bullshit rule, and people are using it. Like, I fucking hate newspapers put these photos up, and then like one random dickhead comes on and say he would have been disqualified if they touched him, and then everyone likes it and shares it and tells their mates at the pub and at work tomorrow they'll use that line. It's fake news though. There is a rule in athletics, I included the post before, that states that the runner won't be disqualified if, I think, let's have a quick...
I'll read it out properly, yeah.
Because this is where people are confused, and it's a load, like, this is the argument that everyone's using where it's not true. And this was posted by an Athletics Victoria employee that I saw. And look, again, this is a screenshot. So, it's IAAF competition rules 2016-2017. So this is old. Like, we're in 2018 now. And it's rule 144, number 4-B. For the purpose of this rule, the following shall not be considered assistance and therefore allowed. B, medical examination / treatment and or physiotherapy necessarily to enable an athlete to participate or continue participation once on the competition area under rule 144.1. So that basically suggests that if he had some medical treatment that got him going again, then he would not be disqualified.
Is that marathoning though, Julian, or is that like somebody coming out for a long jumper and giving them some assistance between jumps?
This is the IAAF competition rules, and this was posted by someone who is in the know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I've seen that over Twitter a couple of times as well this afternoon.
But I guess the other thing as well, like even if the guy waves them off, like if he can't even stand up, it's no different to a rugby league player being knocked out, but him saying, no, I'm good to go. Like he's not, exactly. You know, he's not in a state to make that call.
So I used the example on Twitter of when Zab Judah was knocked out by Kostyuzu, and he's walking around trying to sort of suggest that he wasn't in any sort of pain or he was fully ready to go, and then he just falls over. It's the same thing. Like these guys are warriors. We always love to call our marathoners, oh, they're warriors. They're the toughest guys ever. Well, warriors aren't going to stop on their own accord. They're just going to keep going until they fucking die, like Callum Hawkins would have.
And if you're running head first into a metal railing, you're not all there at the time.
It wasn't like that was our sport anymore. Like I felt really empty and disappointed and. I don't know. I had a weird feeling the whole day thinking about it just because I know that's not what you sign up for and it is a bit of a risk that can happen, but it wasn't enjoyable to watch. It's hard to kind of comprehend in words here. I'm kind of going missing a bit and struggling to explain it, but it was just like, that's not it. Like you get to that stage and someone looks after you and like having relatives calling me this afternoon like, yeah, you sure you want to keep running marathons and stuff like that? And they're kind of looking at that, well, this is the guy winning. What happens if that happens to you? Like, you're not winning. You're never winning. You're kind of back in the pack somewhere. Yeah. Like, it's really left a terrible stain on our sport, which brings us to the next point that we're not looking good overseas. Like, as Australians, especially the spectators on the side of the road, the people videotaping, we're getting called out big time. Paula Radcliffe's come out saying that it was kind of, I will get her quote in a second, and Steve Cram, like some pretty credentialed people in this article from The Guardian, they were pretty harsh on the organisers and the treatment there today. Did you boys read it?
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah.
I had a read.
It's,
but, you know, the people, like, I was thinking the same thing until I drove home and then I sort of calmed down a bit and I thought, okay, let's take the emotion out. Let's put me next to that happening. And Brad sort of suggested, he would have jumped the fence, helped out. But then I'm thinking, well, shit, I don't know what to do. Like, what do I do? Do I roll him over? Do I help him up? Like, I don't think I want to help him up because he shouldn't be going. Like, these people are out there to spectate. They're not medically trained. I think it's really rough to put them on the spot and say, hey, this guy, like, these guys didn't help him out. They're shit humans, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I probably they were more critical on the person that pulled out their phone. That's inappropriate. Yeah, that embarrasses me, isn't it? If that's an Australian citizen, like, that's absolute a joke. Like, you don't do that. Where's your, humanity?
That was fucked. And the fact that she looked like she was employed by someone, I hope someone, like, finds who she is. She loses her job. Like, this is not good enough, like, for someone. Anyway, so, yeah, that, and I think we've covered that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I also just say as well, like, I've had a bit to do with Michael over the years, and I don't know if we've had a guy that is as consistent as him or can always just read his body really well. Like, he always gets the best out of himself on the day, to the point that even today, like, he paced it perfectly so that he was pretty much running on fumes at the end, but just knows his body so well. So I know we've spoken about all the other stuff, but yeah, I guess you don't want to sort of miss Michael's achievement in all that, which is sort of what you said at the start, Julian.
Oh, it's an absolute legend, yeah.
Mm. So from there, let me also sort of state, I don't, like, the race quality and the field was not very good. I don't. Is anyone arguing that? Like, nah. 25 people in the race, probably 10 people with the ability to win the race, I reckon, and
down to five with a 68 first half or so.
Oh man,
I think they're down to five by that point.
17 yeah. finishes.
So we won't, like, we're going to cover the women's as well, but I think the men's race, like, it was the better field even than the ladies' race, but it was still pretty average. Like, I was thinking Michael Schell, like, that Kenneth dude, Mungari, is what, a 210 guy? I mean, a 209 guy. And I'm not sure how good the other guys were, but he was the favourite going in. And he's like a 45-year-old barber. I mean, he's a runs, obviously, and he's a run 209. But this is the favourite for the Comm Games. Like, back when Mona and Deke were running and winning, they were the best in the world at that time. Now the Comm Games is the fields are decimated, basically. Like, the ladies' race, the three Kenyan athletes, one of them was dropped at like 5K and they ran 19 minutes. And the other one, who I had my favourite, her PB, well, she was my favourite Kenyan, but I still thought the two Australians were actually the favourites in the women's race, like the favourite two to win the race. We're talking about, like, Kenya having so many Olympic qualifiers at every single race around the world. Those guys do not give a shit about the Comm Games. They have no care. And I think that's what, like, when we see Michael Schally, Liam Adams, absolutely murdering themselves for their singlet, the Australian girls doing exactly the same thing, it means so much more than it does to other athletes. And Callum Hawkins pushing through with his Scottish singlet on, like, a lot of those Kenyans started to feel the pinch. Or when I say Kenyans, kind of Africans in general, they feel the pinch and it's like, oh, this race doesn't mean shit. I'm stepping off straight away. And they're sending their B team, well, fucking DE teams, really average teams. So I just don't know. Like, it was hard for me to watch that. I loved watching Michael Schally win. He ran a superb race. But look, Rio Olympics was hot, humid, shitty conditions, and they still ran pretty fast. But it was different league. Different. And Australians are going to watch that and go, oh, wow, we're the best in the world. Like, we win the Comm Games. And as a runner, I look at that and go, oh, Michael Schally is a tough bastard. He ran a great race. He's super consistent, but let's not confuse this. Like, he didn't win a world quality race today. Like, there'll be a race on in some third rate European city with a better field than it was today. That'll be on tomorrow.
Yeah. Hamburg next week. Boston. Boston's a big one. But yeah, something like Hamburg or Rotterdam.
Well, yeah, there was some random race in Europe that went through in 66 minutes today. Like, no, we haven't heard of anyone there. Kenyans there, never heard of them. But they'll still run 2:11, 2:12. Anyway, that was the men's side. We'll talk about the ladies' race, because this was
tough as
nails. I was excited for this race. This was a great race. Like, 17 competitors, three Australians, three Kenyans, two Namibians, two English, I think two Welsh, one Sri Lankan, one Trinidad Tobago, one from LES, I don't know what that is, but that's just off the top of my head. It's pretty hard, like, it's pretty weird that I can name that off the top of my head. 17 people, that, like, that's tough to go into a race with 17 people. They were lucky they went slow. If there was a first 5K, that would have been a shitty race for a lot of those girls. Lisa Waitman looked uncomfortable early, so she dropped off the pack, I reckon, a couple of times, and I thought, oh, what's happening? She's the favorite in that race, like, by a mile for me. I had her pegged, like, this girl, like, Lisa is going to win. She's had a great run in. She's a tough. She's trained in Ballarat, which makes her 10 times tougher. But on paper, I saw Lisa Waitman, you're my favorite. And then I checked the odds, and she was like $4, but they still had the three Kenyans in front of it. And I'm like, oh, that's just rough. Like, Lisa's PB is way better than these girls, and she's got better form. So she was my pick from the gun. So when I saw her falling off the pack, I thought, oh no, like, this was your day to have a, like, this was your chance to have a great one. Jess Tringo looked so relaxed early. Like, my favorite to change during the run, I thought, oh, Jess looks way better today. She's gonna
have a belter. Well.
And then Jin is a prolific racer. And she races every weekend normally. So we haven't seen her for several months. So there's clearly, like, obviously there was something going on there. She's obviously coming injured or not too fit. Because if that was working for her, racing so often. So for her to just not race in the last 3 months meant there was something going on. So firstly, Jean, she finished, what was her finish time?
I've got it just here. Give me 2 seconds. I told you I saw her in Bendigo jogging last week. That kind of alarm bells for me. I was like, oh, wonder what she's doing jogging around Bendigo. I know her boyfriend, fiance's there. So maybe just visiting the in-laws that weekend. But I thought, that's strange that you're here and not at altitude or up at the Gold Coast or something. So I think she might have been carrying an injury or a niggle on social media. She was pretty quiet on Instagram as well. But hats off to her getting her body there and being able to finish on race day. She was, did she sneak under 3? Give me 2 seconds. I've got it here.
She's under 3, I think.
She got under? But, like, so. Same thing, like, staggering across the line and, we'll talk about this in a second as well, I'm sure, but whoever's bright idea it was to put it on that hour of the day, I know Nick Bedeau tweeted it, like, a late start for a marathon. Virginia was 16th in 2:58.54. So 16th did it, and there was one person that did not finish. She was last across the line, but in 16th position.
So she wasn't. That's not her. That's her.
Nah, definitely not.
In a very bad way. But then we get into the race, and the Kenyans drop off one by one. Lisa and Jess and a Namibian remain. And I thought, oh, this Namibian, I don't even remember seeing much about her in the lead up. Like, I don't know what her previous PB was. I think I did, like, Google it, but it wasn't anything outrageous. So I didn't really even consider her beforehand. As tough and smart and well-paced as Shelley is, Lisa Waitman is the exact, like, female equivalent, I feel, because she absolutely nailed her pacing for that race. Like, she was never in the front. Like, she didn't charge off after that Namibian, because she knew, like, if she goes off, like, at that point, runs a super hard 5K, she could blow big time and come fifth or sixth. So I think she was really smart in how she went about finishing the race. And then Jess was also pretty smart and tough. I think they both, like, finished their races really well, even if it might have been, like, getting beaten by that Namibian. But the field was pretty poor. Like, on the start line, I thought it will be a very bad day for these Australian girls if at least one of them doesn't get a medal. And I also thought, like, if both don't get a medal, it's hard to, like, Kenyans are a bit unpredictable, but the quality of this field, Jess and Lisa, they're the two favourites for this race. Like, there's a legitimate chance they could go 1-2. So to go 2-3 is a good day for Australia. But I don't think it's like a brilliant day. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the same. And I was surprised to see Lisa off the pace a bit early, and I was a bit worried for her as well. I was like, oh, this doesn't... Because they didn't go through exceptionally fast, and Jess was kind of just rolling along at a nice pace. Like, I don't think Jess was trying to drop anyone. I think she was just trying to keep the pace rolling, and yeah, just on that Nabidian. I don't know if I said that correctly, but yeah, she ran 2:39 at Rio. She ran the Glasgow Com Games in 2:32 to be fifth. So both the girls, well, Jess took care of her there. I don't think Lisa was there. London World Champs last year, 2:32. Like, she's, yeah, kind of thereabouts. But you think girls with PBs of 2:24, 2:26, 2:25-ish would take care of her. But, yeah, she finished pretty strong. Those girls were cooked, though. Like, they gave it absolutely everything. I actually thought Jess was maybe a bit better than she was, but then she crossed the line and lifted the sunglasses, and I think the sunglasses were you kind of hiding a bit of the pain in her face.
Yeah, they were. Everyone that finished was so messed up. No one finished at 90% and walked off. It was crazy to watch. Like, Lisa was so far gone, she couldn't even acknowledge the crowd during the finish straight. Like, she put it on the line hard. You know, if there's no there's no energy to kind of do a few waves or whatnot, you just need to finish because your body's in such distress. That was her. She was on that fine line, I reckon. It was cool to watch.
Yeah, hats off to them, tough as nails. Brad, what do you think?
Yeah, I thought you guys pretty much nailed that recap. I guess in terms of the start times and the weather, it's a tough one in that, like, they're all fit enough to run a marathon in that weather. Like, yeah, what was it? I think it was 27 when the men finished. So it's hot, but they're all capable of doing it. It's just those that are able to, I guess, respect the conditions the most. But then I guess the second part of that is, by running a marathon in those conditions, does the best athlete always win? And maybe not necessarily. Because of all those other factors. I think it's who takes the conditions into consideration when they race that actually does the best.
Runs the smartest race.
Yeah, like even Liam, like, I don't know if you guys saw a shot of Liam at about an hour 25 into the race, and he looked already, like, gone. And that's pretty early into a marathon to be completely cooked. So it's almost like you almost just have to let people go and just trust that, I guess, that internal feeling that you have, and just go, hopefully they blow up down the track and I pick them up, rather than just go along with the pack. And I think that's what Lisa did well. She obviously had that sort of internal feeling that, nah, pace is just a little bit too hot for me at the moment. I'm just going to sit off the back. I guess that's... They're my comments in terms of the starting time and the temperature.
But they kind of did that already, don't you think? Like, they were all pretty conservative through the first... I think they did respect it, and, well, maybe just didn't respect it enough. Like, it wasn't like they went out super fast on suicide missions. I think they all took into account the weather and were conservative, and then it still banged them up really bad.
Yeah, but I think for the men, were conservative for 5K, and then the next 5K was like 15:30 or something, which that's starting to get pretty slick in those conditions. Anyway.
It's a pretty good day for Australian marathon running when you get one gold, a silver and a bronzo. The boss be happy with that. Monteghetti down in Ballarat, Julian, he's been having a big role there.
Yeah, he's done a bit. I see him in every different sport. I don't think he's been to the athletics yet. He's been to every other sport. But, they won medals, but it's almost like it feels like I might as well roll into my moose on the loose here.
I'm feeling the same.
I'm feeling it. I'm like, when I look at the start line, when I was doing some research, there was a potential I was going to get called on for some commentary today, but I didn't, luckily, because I wouldn't be very good. But this was what I came up with, and everyone sort of mentioned it before, the Kenyan athletes who were out there for their women's marathon, one of them, their PB was 2:38, in 2016. Now, this is a Kenyan athlete who's run 2:38 that wouldn't even be close to making the Australian team. You've got Helen Musioka, who PB was 4 years ago, and it was 2:35, still ain't making the Australian team. Last year ran 2:47. Like, 2:47. You're not even finishing in the top 10 of a fucking fun run with that time. Yet here you are running for Kenya in the Commonwealth Games. And then Sheila Jerotich, 2:27. I mean, on a Kenyan, like a Kenyan level, that ain't cutting it. So firstly, like, where the hell are they finding these girls? Because, like, they haven't competed. One of them hasn't competed in 2 years, really, or she hasn't run anything close to worthy of a Commonwealth Games top in 2 years. And then, like, did anyone watch the start line when the gun went off? It was almost like they didn't know what to do. It was like the gun went off, and the Kenyans looked around at each other like, oh, does that mean we start running? And then off they go. And I thought, this is a fucking schmozzle. This is crazy. Within 5K, I looked at the runners and thought, the English and the Australians, and I think maybe the Namibian, she really cared. Like, this was great for her country. Like, I'm guessing they didn't win too many medals this campaign. She had a breakthrough, I reckon, considering I hadn't heard of her much, and she just went and beat a 2:25 girl, a 2:26 girl, and a bunch of others. But I'm just like, I'm a little bit disappointed in the Commonwealth Games. Like, yeah, the Australians won a ton of medals, but these other countries aren't taking it seriously anymore. I think it's almost time where we bring that half marathon in and we get some people who won't waste a marathon there, because clearly the top Kenyans aren't wasting one of their hard marathon paydays on the Com Games. We're getting third or fourth rate athletes to come and compete against us, and I know that that's not what the rest of the field wants. I don't think it's what Kenya wants. Certainly not what, like, the Australian crowds want or the rest of the people watching the Com Games want.
Yeah, did you find that with the track events as well, like watching the whole athletics program?
Well, no, not really, because the guys that were up there were fucking guns. So the Ugandan that won the 5 and the 10K, he's one of the best in the world. Hmm. He's pushing Mo Farah. So
Semenya in the females.
You've got Semenya, you got Callan O'Beery, you got the two steeple guys. They sent a... Their track team was pretty good. Mm. Like, maybe not the depth, but they had Timothy Cherryhood in the 1500. So I don't think I could judge their track team, because they did send some of the real big dogs. But the marathoners, they were nowhere to be seen.
Yeah, fully agreed. Sorry, Brad.
I've just done a quick look on the IAAF rankings, and even for just this year, in the women's marathon, there's been 25... women break 2:30, and that's just this year.
Kenyan, in April.
Kenyan women, did you say?
Kenyan women, yeah. Kenyan women.
and that's just in
4 months.
Cash money, boys. Cash money.
Yeah, I love watching.
A lot of it comes down to culture as well. Like, obviously, the Australian culture, just through, I guess, the history of the Commonwealth Games, that's why it means so much to us. Whereas, as you said, the Kenyans, they just don't care. Like, you know, running for them is more about feeding their families and making money and things like that. So, and there's just not that history of, you know, of Commonwealth Games champions or legends that they want to sort of aspire to be, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know, I agree. And, I think we really have to reaffirm that, like, we love watching the girls and the guys today, like, put their hearts out there. Like, they were amazing.
Yeah,
the Australians, they pushed themselves to places that they really that no one else did, and they deserved those medals. And you put them in a race with those conditions elsewhere, and they're going to perform really well because of their toughness. And so, I very well deserving, and it's just like, this isn't taking anything away from them. It's more about sort of talking about maybe NEXCOM games, I don't know, whether they introduce the half marathon as a more incentive to get the better runners there. We'll see.
Well done. Not too controversial that week. I reckon a few people will agree with you.
Yeah, I think, like, watching 17 people walk out the start line, for me, was like, oh, no, this is rough. Like, Virginia Maloney, I kind of knew, like, without knowing, I kind of knew she wasn't going to be in the front pack. Lucky they went through in 19 minutes, but then that is a long way to run very much by yourself. It's 17 people is rough.
Yeah. Very good, boys. I think we'll cut it there. We'll go to the interview and leave. There's a bit more news going on in the Australian domestic scene. We'll cover that next time we do a podcast. And, we'll do a listener question next time as well. Quickly, what's coming up next week or this week? It's Monday tomorrow. I'm back at work. Fun. Brad, you're on holidays.
Yeah, I start my holidays, so I'm off for the next 2 weeks. So
looking forward to that. He won't be as grumpy anymore. He might actually get a bit out of him this next week.
I've been pretty good tonight, considering I've been up since 4:30.
It's your decision to get up at 4:30. It wasn't for work like me.
I was up at 4:30 as well, yeah.
I don't think I've been that quiet tonight. I don't think I'm quiet in other weeks.
Took him a while to get him on, but we hooked him. Hook, line, and sinker. Julian, what are you doing? 190K week, 90-hour work weeks.
I don't know. I've got a sore Achilles at the end of this run today. So I'm gonna actually decide whether I run in the morning or not, or whether I have a day off.
I got a really good tip for sore Achilles.
No, I'm not touching my shoes.
Hey, you haven't got a coach yet? This could be a bad thing to bring out right now, because it's probably a big, deep conversation. But yeah, talking the other week in the messenger about possibly employing a coach for the wise man.
Nah. I know more than any coach.
Got around that idea, Brad.
Yeah.
I literally decided within 2 minutes after I sent you a message saying, hey, I'm thinking about this. And then in 2 minutes, I'm like, no. These guys have it all wrong. I know how to do it.
Oh, I thought you were still in the market. I just thought you'd cut that coach off. I thought you'd be maybe still looking.
Nah.
And then didn't Brady say, I swear you're bipolar, Julian? Because, like, within the space of 2 minutes, you've changed your mind 3 times.
Tell you what, coach, if you want. I had a real good day at Canberra Marathon today. Couple of boys ran really well up there. You'd be pretty proud of my coaching efforts today. Two listeners.
I had a fella finish second at the Buffalo Stampede Marathon, so that's a win.
Yeah.
And also fifth place Thursday maybe in the half marathon there. Big wins.
Oh yeah. I don't know about that. I had a 2:48 drop down to a 2:42. Fifth overall at Canberra. David Russell. Shout out to him. Good effort. Under 3:40 down to a 3:13. That was Dan Craig. Pretty solid there, boys. Well done. Making me look good.
Who said Canberra's slow?
Yeah, I know. That was off.
They're a bit short, is it?
That was off the back of a Gold Coast one as well. A 6-minute PB from Gold Coast to Canberra.
Give it a spell, man.
That's worth 10 minutes. BradyTrailful.com/coaching. We're done. Interviewed Clint Perrott this week. Had a ball talking to Clint. He was one of my heroes when I first entered the sport at the ripe age of 16. I remember watching him dominate the AV cross country and road races, and he's got a remarkable story. I didn't actually realise most of it until we sat down and over Skype and had this conversation. But yeah, a really good, enjoyable interview. I think you'll get a bit out of this, and just the way I kind of accidentally wrapped it together at the end, and we hear about his running journey. You guys have much to do with him in the day?
His coach was my coach. We did it like an easy run or something together before he went to Switzerland. But yeah, Mark Gorski used to coach him, at the same time that it's coaching me.
Right, I didn't realise that. Just like his story about the transition to the marathon is quite interesting, actually. When you hear his PBs about the 10 and the 5 and the half marathon, and then hear his marathon journey, it's quite a roller coaster. Brad, you know him?
Yeah. I raced him at, I think, a couple of national crosses, and he probably did his Zatopek, but yeah, I was never anywhere near him.
Jeez, he would have towed you up back in the day over cross country, I reckon.
He would have been too far in front, you wouldn't even recognise him.
Hey, I finished seventh, I think, at National Cross once.
Probably lapped him.
Seven out of ten.
Probably lapped him, and Brad wouldn't have got off the rail to get out of the way, I reckon. Made him go wide. Yeah. All right, I'm getting this on iTunes so the listeners can listen to this. Thanks, boys. Thanks for your time. I want to make that point to the listeners that it's 9 o'clock at night, and these guys have had big days, and we've kind of gone out of our way to get this out early today. So thank you for tuning in, and big thanks to Brad and Julian for giving up their time for something that we do for free. And I'm actually feeling better about it. I was feeling a bit empty before I talked to you guys tonight, and a bit not sure what to make of this whole marathon situation today. So I'm glad we had a bit of a debrief, and I think the listeners will appreciate that as well. Over and out. Thanks, boys. All right, Quentin Perrott, welcome to the Inside Running Podcast. Thanks for joining us, giving up a bit of your Saturday afternoon to have a chat to us and the audience.
No worries. Pleasure to be here, boys. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's good. And a lot of people won't, I'd like to think a lot of people would recognise your name, but it's been a few years since you've been around the running tracks.
I was probably running competitively probably 5 years ago before, you know, Instagram, Facebook, podcasts even had taken off. So my social media and internet name is probably pretty small compared to some of the current athletes where they're on TV and they're on radio all the time and getting their name out there social media-wise. I think my career was a little bit before all that, so yeah.
Yeah, it was funny researching you actually, because there's not a lot around, and I actually was going through, remember the old Athletics Victoria like videos and things like that? I was watching one today when you won the state 15K champs at used to be La Trobe Uni. Can you remember that?
That's
one?
That's right. Yeah, that was a good one. I think Mono was racing in that one.
Yeah, you dropped him with 5K to go.
That's right. No, it was a good one.
That is good. But we must introduce you to the audience. So you're pretty elite runner. You've represented Australia six times, 3 world cross countries and 2 world half marathons and 1 Ekiden relay over in Japan. Have I got that right?
That sounds about right. I think that's about right, yeah.
3K PB of 8.04, 5K 13.46, 10K 28.58, half marathon 63.41, and marathon 2.17.
Yeah, that seems like a long time ago. I don't know if I'd be able to match those times these days, but I started out as a lot of runners start out with the shorter distance and keep progressing as the up in distances and stuff like that. I think I found my niche somewhere around half marathon, not quite marathon, but probably would have liked to really nail a marathon. So that was probably the differences.
Yeah, and just looking at your progression as well, just on the internet this morning, it looked like it was kind of a gradual, kind of you just kept chipping away and, really made it a bit there kind of at the right time when you just come out of juniors.
Yeah, look, to be honest, during the junior days, like I went to a school where we did cross country during the winter and athletics during summer, and, you know, that was my focus. We had training a couple of times a week and all that sort of stuff, but I was training, but nothing too serious. It wasn't until I kind of hit, you know, when I had more time after high school that I actually decided, all right, I'm going to have a crack at this sport that I think I've got some sort of talent in, and started training properly, and then started getting some good junior results as a result of that. But then sort of at that age of whatever, was it 21, 22, you think you're bulletproof, so I was training the house down like a bit of an idiot, and ended up getting injured and stress fractures in the foot and stuff like that. I think I went over to Europe as a 24-year-old and I raced 3 times a week for a month straight, and then wondered why I got a stress fracture in the foot. So I had to sort of back it off, and sort of I had a good couple of years, and I had a couple of years in the wilderness, and then I kind of had to come back slowly and with a little bit more of a wiser head and just slowly chipping away at it. And unfortunately, injury sort of stopped me getting probably as far as I would have liked to in those last couple of years. But, there was probably a couple of years in there sort of in my late 20s where I was hitting the straps and getting the times and the results that I was really chasing along the way.
Yeah, right. So take me back to those high school days. Like, were you in the private school system down there and doing the private school races and stuff like that?
Yeah, so I attended Broughton Grammar. I was back in grade six. I was running, I think, state champs, and one of the coaches and teachers from the school came up and tapped my mum and dad on the shoulder and said, "Hey, your son's done pretty well. I'm from Broughton Grammar, and would you be interested in having a chat to us about a scholarship?" And my folks, like, I was signed up to go to St. Bede's, where my brother went in Mentone, and great school, and I'd done the orientation day and everything. But mum said, "Do you want to go have a look at it?" So I had a look, and she said, like, I live down in Edithvale, so that the journey from Edithvale to Brighton would be 40 minutes driving, but via public transport it was about 90 minutes with all the changes of trains and buses and stuff. So I said to mum, "All right, I'll give it a try for a year, and worst case scenario, I'll just, you know, if it doesn't work out, I'll go back to St. Bede's." But, you know, in once you get there and you get knowing friends and getting involved, and it wasn't until the sports really kicked in, the APS system, the Associated Privates, Public School System, I think it's called, system really kicked in, that I was like, "Well, okay, this is the separation between, you know, like your general high school and a private school like this. That's a big difference." And so I was like, "All right, I'm going to stick this one out," and really enjoyed the racing, and raced against some guys in other private schools, you know, Caulfield Grammars and Scotches and things like that, and progressed my way through there. But at the same time, was still kind of wanting to get something out of being at a good school like that. So I focused on my studies and, you know, making sure I did reasonably well there also. So as I said just quickly earlier, it wasn't really until kind of 17, 18 that I decided that I'd have a real crack at running, and had made some really good friends through running, so decided to stick with it, and that was sort of the transition into a bit more serious results.
Yeah, it's a pretty good move though, like smart thinking for a kid at 16 to kind of almost hold yourself back in that competitive environment.
Yeah, look, I'm not sure if you recognise the name Trent Wallace, but he went to Broughton Grammar as well, and he was a superstar junior, and for whatever reason, he was absolutely untouchable. I think he won it. He won every APS cross country race, which is I don't think anyone's ever done since or before him. Even De Castella, who attended Xavier back in the 70s, couldn't even do things like that because of the competition. So I think he won every cross country race, and we were racing guys like Simon Field, who was a world representative in the end. I think I came second in my year 12 to him in every race, so we were going 1-2, and I was sort of looking at him going, "Wow, he's doing a lot, but he's doing really well, but he's also training a lot." And I was sort of just trying to be patient and maybe learn a little bit from him, because my focus was to try and get through school first and then you know, follow a career, knowing that distance running is about being patient and playing the long game a little bit. So, and also my folks were being really good role models. They were sort of saying, "Look, you know, you're a good runner, you enjoy it and all that sort of stuff, just keep enjoying it, no pressure, and but also balance." And I was working a part-time job at Safeway, packing shelves. I was attending school and also doing the running as well. So I think that work ethic you sort of have to establish, and I thank my folks for that. They were excellent in getting that started.
Yeah, and then so things get serious, you know, kind of year 11, 12, first year out, and then I don't know, I just remember watching you. I was just starting, I must have been like 16, and I remember like going to AV races when I was 16, and you'd be out the front with like Troopy and Mono, what we spoke about before, and even like those Sandown 10Ks with like Ben St. Lawrence would come down, and like you were, all of a sudden it just seemed like you were there. So like, how did that transition happen?
To be honest, I had some really good junior coaches, and they held me back a little bit for a while. And finally, when I turned 18, you know, I could then drive up to run with the boys at Fernie Creek. I could drive myself to training and do those extra little bits. The first few coaches that I had were really, I guess, maybe track-based, so they ingrained in me in flexibility and strength and stuff like that. So I was doing a bit of gym work, and that started to pay off in terms of I was developing my core, my strength better than maybe some other distance runners at the junior age. And I think that started to pay off when I hit my early 20s, and I was able to be competitive. And then, you know, I was showing up at races and as a 20, 21-year-old, but racing Droopy and the big boys. And I was like, well, I'm here to race, so I might as well go out with them and see what I can do. And then you start believing when you start having some good results. So you start looking back at your training as well. Like I was pretty diligent in keeping a little training diary. I know nowadays they've got Strava and Training Peaks and whatever else all online. Back in the day, it was a little calendar for me, and I just wrote down what I did that day. And then pre-race, I'll go back and go, you know what, I've had 2 months or 3 months of uninterrupted. I haven't missed a training and stuff like that. And that stuff kind of builds your confidence as well. And I don't think I had any more skill or talent than any of the other guys, but I was very consistent, and I think that's the key. And a lot of the other guys around my age now who have gone through and maybe even achieved even better, like boys like Collis and stuff like that, they, Collis Birmingham, they were the same, like they just never missed a day. He's had a few injuries more recently, but back in the day, one of the reasons he was unstoppable was because he could train day in, day out without injury, without fatigue. And I've sort of learnt from that a little bit as well. I could bounce back from a hard training session and go again, maybe to my detriment further down the track as I got a little bit older. But when I'm 21, 22, I was able to get away with it and sort of get results up against some of the older guys and some of the more established fellas.
Yeah, and can you remember what training looked like then, Clint? Like, what was a standard week?
Yeah, look, to be honest, and even I still do this now when I'm on the bike cycling, and I was doing it when I was a little bit older, but a normal week I would probably train pretty much, once I built myself up to it, like in my early 20s, twice a day every day, except for Sunday's long run, and maybe a Wednesday long middle to long run. So I just train once on that day. And I'll hit the gym 3 times a week. If it was just a circuit at home or go to the gym and lift some stuff. I was stretching diligently, you know, while watching the footy or watching TV in the evening and stuff like that. So, you know, once I committed to something, I'm pretty stubborn, and I said, all right, well, this is what I want to do, and I want to be good at it. I don't want to just, you know, be running and coming third and fourth and stuff like that. It's nice. I want to be right at the top. And amongst my training buddies, we started this little thing, a point system thing, and then I started competing against them to get points. So we would allocate a point if you did a morning run. You'd get a point if you did your stretching that night. You get a point if you went to the gym. You get a point if you got 8 hours sleep. So we sort of tried to, you know, motivate each other, and that seemed to really work for a good couple of years, just to get the groundwork in there. And once I moved out of home in my early 20s, I actually moved in with a running buddy of mine, and I would kick open his door at six in the morning and say, all right, let's go. And he had an automatic training partner right there as well. So he probably hated me at the time because I wanted to get out and train, and I was getting results as well, and he was just like dragging along, and he got some results along the way. He was at more of an 800 guy, a little bit older than me, but just having that training partner in your household, and you'd be like, oh, we probably shouldn't go out and get pissed tonight, we've got a big session tonight or the next day or whatever it is, or a race coming up. So having someone like that was always good as well. But a normal training week, I guess if you sort of break it down from Monday to Sunday, yeah, I'd probably run 2 easy runs on a Monday, sort of 30 and 60, or towards marathon days would be more like 45 and 70. Tuesday, I'd do a session either at the Tan or on the track, or even Faulkner Park we used a fair bit as well, or the Yarra River Trail a little bit as well. Wednesday would just be a long run from home. I lived in Bayside, so in Brighton area for a little while, so I'd run along the trails there. Try to stay on the soft stuff as much as possible as well. And then once I started working, I was teaching up in the city. I was living on the Yarra Trail, so I'd run through the Yarra Bend Park and all that sort of stuff. And again, kind of stay on the soft stuff just because it was a little bit better on the legs. And then Thursday, hit a threshold or an interval session of some sort. Friday, a little bit of an easier day. Saturday, usually meet the guys out Yarra Flats, do a session out there, like a threshold, 30, 40 minutes, whatever it was, depending on the session, or hills, hill reps. We went, used to go to Walmer Street. I'm not sure if you know that one in Melbourne. It's often in Kew, and it's one of the steep, one of the hardest sessions I remember doing. Like, it was, I remember having a heart rate monitor on and being at like 204 beats at the top of that thing, and just thinking like I was dizzy and like lying down and stuff like that. And
can you remember how long it was in the elevation?
Yeah, I actually do it on the bike a little bit now these days. It's about 400 meters. So it used to take you just over a minute, and it was at about 5% or something like that. So I don't know the elevation gain that it was, but it was a ball terror from the start. And you get to the top, and, and then you just turn around and jog back down and hit it again. So that was Saturday. And then Sunday, most of the time, if I wasn't racing, I'd go out to Fernie and meet the guys in the car park there and do up to 2.5 hours by the end, but usually 2 hours over the rolling hills. And, you know, back in the day before GPS watches, I'd guesstimate that it would be about 28 Ks. And then you'd look at your watch and you'd be like, oh, shit, I've only done 25 Ks. But, you know, the 2.5 hours worth of rolling hills was definitely well and truly worth not running as far in terms of distance. So that was probably a normal week for me as I was progressing through. But getting to that long run of 2.5 hours, like, I was really quite strict on myself after I came back from that second lot of injury, you know, in my after stress fractures and stuff. So I used to progress my long run from like by 1 minute every single Sunday. So I'd go like 1:45, and then I'll go 1:46 the week after, and 1:47. And some of the guys would be like, what are you doing, mate? Why are you running? And I'm like, well, I've got to get 47 this week, and next week I'm going for 48. Which sounds a bit ridiculous now when you talk about it, but I was trying to make sure I didn't overload and have to have another setback. So all those little bits and pieces of the puzzle sort of came together to kind of mean that the results were starting to flow through. And, you know, then other people started doing the same, because they're like, oh, well, Clint's going all right, so maybe I'll, you know, slowly build up my long run and stuff like that. So I sort of started a bit of a trend in that way.
Yeah, and tell us about Fernie Creek. Like, we had Trevor Vincent on the other week, and he was one of the guys who, like, started it up in a way. And, like, were you guys racing each other or picking up the pace? Or, like, who were the people in the group as well? Like, I could imagine it was quite competitive.
Yeah, oh, look, we had some, you know, like, sometimes, especially if there was racing going on, you'd have some guys that it would be as hard as a race. And the most of the group that I'd go up there with would be, you know, you'd have your juniors and your boys and the girls and the older guys and the younger ones as well. But most of the people I would actually do most of the running with was guys like Alpha Helio, who's still going around, Ben Toomey, Simon Field, Buster Mottram would be up there if he was in town. I think even Dave McNeil started coming up there before he's a couple of years younger than me. Who else would be there was a fair few of us. I can't even remember some of the names of the guys, but you'd get up to like 20 guys, and the first loop that you do, you sort of go out and you do 30 minutes, and usually it's pretty fresh and pretty cool up there. So you start with your long sleeve and then chuck that off as you come back past your car, and then you sort of gradually drop your way down. It's all off-road as well, which is good on, you know, building strength on your ankles and stuff like that. But you're gradually going down, and everybody's in a nice chatty mood and stuff like that, and, you know, catching up on the week and whatever. And you get to the bottom, which is actually down at Puffin Billy in Belgrave there, the big steam train. And then you turn left and start working your way up the hill. And that was when it was like, all right, let's have a bit of a dick-swinging contest here. And you just basically just go hard until you got to the top and then see who was left. And usually there'd be two, maybe three of you left. And some guys from that point, that was would head up back up to the cars. That would be about a 90-minute. And then there would be another loop you could add in. And it was pretty tough and rolling as well. There was a couple of rolling hills in there. We used to call one of them the Deceiver as well, because it doesn't look like much, but it's this long, straight hill. But because you've already busted yourself trying to drop everybody on the long hill, this one hurts your legs even more. And that got you back to the cars in about 2 hours, and then you sort of added an extra little loop to make an extra half an hour through the Botanic Gardens and stuff, and it winds up some kind of switchbacks, and then you'd look back down on guys that you'd just dropped and make sure that they knew that you looked fresh and stuff like that. So it became a little bit of a pecking order type thing as well. And I remember getting to the top of that and thinking, well, geez, I'm going to race this guy next Saturday, and I've just dropped him on Sunday's long run. So that gives me some good confidence, and hopefully vice versa, they're thinking, oh, geez, what am I going to do to overcome this guy on Saturday week or whatever it might be. So, look, Fernie Creek, I think, was a great breeding ground for building strength, especially in the winter months when, you know, you're not racing as fast and as serious. And then when it came to some of the summer races, especially track time, you'd go, well, maybe don't go up to Fernie. I'll save the legs a little bit because I've got a race coming up and stuff. So that was the normal structure of the day.
Yeah, right. And then for 2009, that's when things, or 2008, 2009, things started to click for you. You were winning the kind of Athletics Victoria races in the winter. You won the National Cross in 2009, like one of the best runners in Australia at that stage.
Yeah, things started to come good. And I think it was just an accumulation of a couple of years of unbroken injury, no injury or no stops, and sort of figuring out my body, figuring out what I needed, how much rest I needed. And I was also a little bit more established by that stage. I'd finished my studies. I was working as a school teacher. So, you know, your hours were just a bit more regular. You know, you go to work at 8 and you finish at 4 or 5 or whatever it is. And where actually my first job as a teacher was on halfway up Anderson Street at Melbourne Girls Grammar. So I was already at training by the time I finished work. So I'd walk out of work, jog down to the bottom of the hill and meet the guys for warm-up. So I just had a really good structure happening with life. And then I'll just drive home, have dinner, do everything that I needed, and then pack it up for the night and do it all again. So it was just, I think, an accumulation of injury-free, consistent training, and the confidence starts building a little bit as well when you start having some good results. So they start piling up on each other, and you go to races feeling ready to race rather than, you know, a bit more skeptical and worried about what the result might be. So
yeah, can you remember one race you had where that kind of mindset shifted and you kind of you knew you'd arrived a bit?
To be honest, it's probably nationals when I had the win there. I wasn't really sure how I was going to go, but I remember, I think I was rooming with Nathan Hardigan that we stayed in Nowra, and we had Dua with us as well, Dua Yoa. Yeah. He was staying in the other room, and some of the other Ballarat boys. And so, like, I remember we went out for dinner that night, and normally, you know, you want to have pasta or something like that, something good to eat before big race, you know, especially nationals. And I think the pasta with the pizza restaurant we went to they'd run out of pasta or some crap like that. So I was like, I'll stuff it, I'll get a Meat Lovers pizza, and nailed that one thing, that down. And I remember Nathan going, mate, what are you doing? Like, you've got a big race tomorrow and you're the favorite. And I was like, oh shit, I hadn't even thought that I'm the favorite. And then I was like, no, I turned to him and said something smart. I was like, who are you to give me diet advice? You've just had seven Coca-Colas as your dinner or something like that. And so I actually rocked up to the race feeling quietly confident. And, you know, I think the difference I remember from running and now doing a bit more cycling is when you get to the race, you know, within, unless you have an absolute shocker, you know, all right, you know, I'm in 30-minute shape or I'm in 15-minute shape for a 5K or whatever it might be, you know what shape you're in. So I knew, based on the training, what shape I was in, and I knew the course at Nowra was going to suit me because it was kind of a grinder's course. So it was pretty heavy on foot, and had a big hill out the back and quick downhill and then around and up again. So I knew it was going to be tough, which kind of suited my style of kind of running off the front. And so I sort of put a couple of surges in and broke the field up sooner than I thought. And I think at that stage, only Liam Adams and Jeff Hunt were still with me at halfway. And I think I followed Jeff up the big hill at the back and got to the very top. And he made this big exhalation, like, oh, that was hard. And I was like, well, it doesn't feel too hard for me. And he had a teammate, Dave Byrne, at the top, who he did a bit of training with, and he yelled out something, go Jeff or whatever. And he didn't cheer for me, even though I know Dave for a fair bit. And I don't know, that kind of fired me up, and I was like, all right, I'm having a crack here. So I actually attacked him on the downhill. I just took off and got to the bottom of the hill, and there was a U-turn. I could see I'd made 20 seconds on him. And then I had a little smile to myself, and I'm like, shit, I might win nationals here. That'll be a nice little thing to have on your resume, your running resume. And I ran through the line, and I was dead at the end of it, but I kind of felt like that was one of those days where everything just clicked and everything went together. And after that, like, once you win a nationals, you're like, all right, well, I belong, and, you know, I should be up near the pointy end when it comes to World Cross Trials, which are the next aim, and you know, the next big competition. When you show up with a national title, I guess you kind of you feel like you know, you should be having some good results, and people start looking towards you to push the pace a little bit or to respond to your pace rather than having to do the other thing. And I think it's definitely an advantage if you're in a race and you're the one hurting other people rather than them doing it to you, and you're like, oh shit, I just need to hang on. If you're doing that to others, then that's a huge advantage, I reckon. And I think having a few results along the way definitely helped with changing that mentality, knowing that I was ready to go.
And like back in 2009 and that kind of era, like cross country for nationals was super deep as well. Like you had guys like Marty Dent hooking around and Troopy and Shelley running, and like,
yeah.
Do you look at the results now and just like think you got a bit ripped off running around back then?
I do actually, but I'm also like, I'm super pumped to see that guys like Shelley and Adams are still out there and having really good results. And, you know, part of me thinks, oh shit, if I'd have just stuck with it, maybe I'd be in the Gold Coast right now and stuff like that, because the times, you know, the qualifying times have changed a little bit as well. Like the year that I thought I was in best shape to try and qualify for London, and then I think the year after was World Champs as well. You know, marathon qualifying time was 2:12.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, like, I know I'm not in 2:12 shape, but I knew I was in 2:14, 2:15 shape. But you have to go out at 2:12 shape because you're like, well, if I don't get the qualifier, I'm not going. So, and I think that was just as a result of having the depth and the strength of at numbers and at cross country level. Like, I remember doing a World Cross Trials around the Canberra course and coming eighth and then looking ahead at the names. I'm like, well, all these guys here have either been on a national team or, you know, have travelled internationally for their running, so it's no terrible effort. But at the same time, you're like, you're knocking on the door, and I was knocking on the door for a couple of years, and I sort of was getting close and wanted to just sort of break through, and I had a couple of years where I broke through and actually was in, and then unfortunately I had a few results where a few issues where with injury that meant that I had to stop before I really wanted it to stop. Yeah.
And is it safe to say, would you rate your best distance as half marathon back then? Because like back in 2009, like you won Melbourne in 64 and you went on to run 63s a couple of times. Like, was that your favorite? And rated as the most successful distance?
I think like the way that I was put together, or the way, you know, my different strengths in terms of threshold, holding a good threshold pace, I think a 60-minute effort, like a half marathon effort, was definitely my best. I had to really, sometimes the long runs, I had to really concentrate and think about nutrition and hydration and stuff, and, you know, managing my body and not going out too hard and stuff. So I never really nailed a marathon, but the half marathon I seemed to enjoy the most and have the best results in, I think. I'd say the half marathon was my best result. And, you know, you look at my half marathon time and you do the maths and all that, and you think, well, you should be able to run X time for the full marathon. But unfortunately, it doesn't just translate for every single person, doesn't translate straight across. You know, you don't say, I don't know what the calculation used to be, something like your half marathon times 2 plus 8 minutes or something. It used to be Mona's little thing. And if you do that, yeah, if you do that, then I'm, you know, should be running sort of 2:13 sort of thing for a marathon. But it wasn't that wasn't quite that simple, unfortunately. So the half marathon, like, I remember having a couple of half marathons, and just, you know, you don't have to hydrate so much. You don't have to take, you know, I might take one gel, if anything, in a half marathon. So it's more just about just holding speed for an hour. And I can go through 10K in a half marathon and then negative split off that most times and things like that. So I think that was definitely my preferred distance in terms of results as well. You know, I had a...
Well, take us back to that, like the marathon debut, like 2010. You'd come for 5K PB that year as well, been to World Cross at Poland and came 68th, which some of our listeners might think 68th isn't that impressive, but when you chuck in, what are there, 6 or 8 Kenyans in each one of those races, and Ethiopians and Ugandans, and the top 25 spots they fill up pretty quick. Let's maybe talk about Poland for a while, that first World Cross experience.
That was my first big team, or first big senior team. I'd made World Juniors back in 2002, I think, World Cross Juniors, and then there was a bit of time until I finally made it as a senior. And I got close in terms of qualifying the two previous years, and then the year that I made Poland, I think it was my it was my first year as a teacher. So I got the 6 weeks, 7 weeks off as summer holidays. And what do you do when you've got holidays? So I went up, and I was renting a place with Hardigan and a few other guys. And
up at Falls Creek?
Yeah, up at Falls. And we just trained like mad dogs for 6 weeks. I came off that mountain absolutely best form I've ever been. That World Cross trial, I think Collis and I cleared out in the last 3-4 Ks, and I rolled up next to him, and I think he turned to me and he said, "We're clear, we're good," and basically just sort of say, like, we don't have to keep pushing. But I wanted to just keep rolling because I was feeling pretty good. So him and I got away and qualified. He qualified first, I was second for that, and then going to Poland, I was like, well, I'm in good shape, and I think I actually knocked off Collis in that race in Poland on that day. So, you know, I came 68th, but I think Liam was the first Aussie finisher, and I might have been second finisher. But it was a tough old course. Like, it had been snowing, and then that snow turned to mud, and it was like not typical Australian cross country conditions that we know, which is pretty much running on a golf course, nice and lush, and pretty sure underfoot. Like, it was proper hard European type cross country, and maybe that was one factor. And like, I crossed the line in 68th. I was a little bit annoyed, a little bit disappointed. I would have liked to go top 50 based on, you know, the form and the build up and all that sort of stuff, but you know, it is what it is in terms of results. And I gave everything I could on that specific day, and it was just nice to sort of get one under the belt in terms of making a senior national team. And, you know, my goal from that then on was to try and continue to make that team year in, year out, and world half team, and then step up into hopefully, you know, world champs, Comm Games, or an Olympic team somewhere along the track, which didn't quite eventuate, but that was kind of the start of what was hoped to be a regular appearance in the green and gold.
Yeah, so moving into the London Marathon, like in April, that good performance at World Cross, as I said, that kind of PB over 5K, you would have had your sights set on a pretty big debut?
Yeah, like my coach at the time was Mark Gorski, who's not coaching anymore. He's a Melbourne-based former runner, and we were talking, and based on my results and my times and things like that, I was expecting to hopefully go like 2:15 or so, and went out pretty well and had a bit of a group to go with. And then from about 25 to 30, they all just either pulled out or hit the wall and disappeared. And I was running solo for the last 17 Ks or whatever it was. And I think that meant that I lost a bit of time towards the end. So I think I ran about 2:18 in London, but came 13th because a lot of people ahead of me were just dropping out, pulling over and sitting in the gutter sort of thing. Because, you know, if in London, one of these big events, you're either there to win it and take home the big prize pool, or you pull out and go run Vienna or something if you're one of the top African runners or whatever it is. But for me, I was like, well, I'm debuting, so I'm getting across the line and finishing. So it's a fast course, and I reckon I could have gone quicker if I had have got it right. But 2:18 on debut was not a bad result, and knowing that, I was like, okay, I reckon I could probably slice a couple of minutes off that if I get a few things right next time around. And it was good sort of to open the account, I guess, the marathon account, and get one under the belt, yeah. Safe and sound.
And was there a reason you chose London for the first one?
So at that stage, I'd finished the World Cross in Poland, and I'd actually quit my job and was taking a year off to live in Europe. I was dating a European girl at the time, so we decided to move to Switzerland and try life over there. So I actually didn't go home from Poland. I stayed in. I flew from Poland back to Switzerland and then started living over there, a new life over there, which was a bit of a mental struggle as well. Going from working every day to not, I didn't have work lined up at that stage, and the next goal was London, and I decided, well, it had to be a European race because that's where I was living now, and I thought it was a great opportunity to actually be living in Europe because you're at the doorstep of so many excellent races week in, week out, you know, and everything's so close in terms of different comps and different races and stuff like that. So I was all excited about that factor. And I chose London because, in my mind, I wanted to do all the majors, and that was one of. So I asked one of the – it was Global – I just can't remember the name. One of the big management companies. I was with Adidas at this time, and they had connections with Global Communications, which is one of the management teams. And they said they could get me in as one of the Adidas-sponsored white boys. So I took them up on the offer, and the goal was to try and do as many of the majors as I could. So just before I hung up the running shoes, the next goal was to try and do Berlin, but never quite got there. And that was the other European one I really wanted to do. But I started off with the major and then realised that, you know, the majors, they usually run... They run them at, you know, world record pace, and then if you're not a world record pace, then you're just you don't have paces or anything like that. It's just up to you. So that's why I sort of, in my next couple of marathons, I moved back to sort of the B level races, or the step down from the big gold label races, to try and get a group of guys that I could run with rather than run solo.
Yeah, right. And so then 2011, next one was in Amsterdam, and like a PB there, but probably still not the breakthrough you were after in the marathon?
No, it's funny because that was a perfect race for me if everything went well, because we had a group going through, and they had a Dutch guy who ended up running qualifying for the Olympics in that event, in that race. And his goal time was 2:13. I was like, boom, perfect. I've got a group to run on. And I was with the group till 28Ks. I was still with them on the back of them at 30Ks. So I'm at 2:13 pace. And then the wheels fell off in the last 10Ks. And I don't really know what it was. I was training really well. But again, I think it's just maybe my body... I was a good half marathon runner. I was a good 30K runner, but the marathon just and me didn't quite match up in terms of just getting it right. And maybe I could have spent a bit more time tweaking the training a little bit more. I was still pretty new at it and still pretty raw. But I was on 2:13 pace and shuffled home and lost 5 minutes in the last 10Ks to make it 2:17. Which again, I got a PB and I came across the line with nothing left to give, but knowing that, geez, if I get one of these right, like I can really run 2:13, 2:14 pace, because up until that point I was feeling pretty good, and I didn't hit the wall in that race. I just my muscles, they actually felt like they'd been sledgehammered. Like breathing wise and all that sort of stuff, I was still going okay. I just started cramping in the quads and in the hip flexors and stuff. And I remember at the end of the race, I sat down with my legs out in front of me. And then when I came to stand up, I couldn't bend my knees to sort of stand up because my hip flexors had locked up and all that sort of stuff. So I think it was more of a biomechanics thing rather than biomechanic fatigue rather than hitting the wall, you know, the classic wall of a marathon runner.
Yeah, running out of the glycogen there.
Yeah. So unfortunately, look, I just didn't quite nail a marathon, which is a little bit frustrating. That's the one kind of regret I have as a runner and with my career, because, you know, marathon is one of those events. It's got such a name behind it, and everybody says, oh, you've run marathons, and oh, what was your best time? And you tell them, and they say, oh, that's impressive. And you're like, yeah, but it doesn't get you anything. Like, I never won a marathon. I never got a qualifying time because of my marathons. I ran a fast-ish time, you know. And I think my best result was, yeah, London. I finished 13th. That was one of the highest results I had. So, you know, I still didn't even finish top 10 in the races that I was doing. So, yeah.
Yeah, and at that stage too, like, are you wondering what the future's going to hold? Like, obviously no half marathon at the Olympics or Com Games, and that's your best distance, and, you know, probably not the 10K speed to get on the team for 10K, and then not being successful, well, still amazing times over the marathon, but still nothing near that, you know, the 212, which you kind of had to run back in the day to kind of hit a qualifier, and giving up work and living overseas, like, was it a bit sketchy there for a while?
Yeah, it was, to be honest. And it's funny you say about the 10K, because I was looking at the 10K going, geez, I wish I was a 10K runner. How, you know, run hard for 30 or 28 minutes, whatever it is, and then you're done.
Yeah.
I wish I was a 10K runner.
But do it every 3 weeks.
Yeah. Then we had Collis setting the national record and then Benny going and taking it off him. So those two guys are running two fastest Aussies ever.
In history.
And I'm like, oh, sweet, mate. Like, so there's one spot left, and then most of the time Dave McNeil would snag that one, or they'd only take the two of them, or whatever it was. So, like, the times that those guys were running were, we still haven't seen since, and they were the fastest in Australia in history. So I was like, well, obviously I'm not going to go down the 10K path, so marathon is me. And I thought I could be a pretty good marathon runner based off my athletic profile and all those sort of bits and pieces. So I thought I could be a good marathon runner. I thought maybe I just need to tweak the training a little bit to be a bit more less speed-based and more endurance-based. And actually, after Amsterdam, I actually changed to a Swiss-based coach rather than – I was still getting coached by Gorski. By correspondence, by email and all those sort of things, and phone calls every now and then. But it was just too hard to do, because, you know, like, I might wake up with a bit of a sniffle and I'd want to call him and say, hey, can we hold off on the session? And it would be 3 o'clock in the morning sort of thing over there. So I actually changed coach to a Swiss guy. He was on this, he was a Swiss national coach, which Athletics Australia used to have a distance national coach, and I don't think they have that anymore, but he was the Swiss version of that. So his job basically was full-time looking after Swiss distance runners, and I happened to be dating a Swiss distance runner, so he took me on as well. And I started to have some good success because of that, because, you know, he could come and watch some of my sessions, or he'd be on the bike giving me drinks and gels during a long run and stuff like that. So I had a bit more feedback, and I thought that might be the difference in terms of making that step from, you know, a 2:17 marathon to hopefully a qualifying time in the marathon sort of thing. So for one of the big champ teams.
Yeah, and you kicked off that year, like 2012, with that half marathon PB in Italy, like 63:41. So everything must have been looking up for this breakthrough has got to happen over the marathon.
Yeah, definitely. And I trained through winter for that, because that was the northern winter. And I rolled up in Varese in Italy, which we actually, it's pretty cool because you get to just catch a train from home, express train down to Italy, cross the border, and then we stayed in this awesome hotel. They put us up there. And did this half marathon, and there was, I think I came fifth or sixth or something like that. but the leaders took off. They went out in like, they went out crazy, like 240, 245 for the first, first K. And I was like, see you boys, I'm running 3 minute Ks on the dot. And that's what I ended up running, three minutes average, I think it was. And I was solo. So I said to my coach at the time, I'm like, look, I ran basically a time trial, within a race. I had a race number on, but I was solo time trialing. And I ran 3 minute Ks. So surely if I back it down to like marathon pace of 3:12s or something like that, like surely I can hold that. So I was, yeah, feeling pretty confident, going forward, looking forward to a marathon, looking forward to the next marathon, which, unfortunately was my worst or my second worst, I should say.
Yeah. So Brighton, yeah, in the UK, like a bit of a lower kind of hyped one. And was the plan to maybe go there and like win it and sit with the leaders and put them away in the last couple of Ks?
Yeah, that was the plan. And again, like the goal was choose, well, to be honest, initially the one I was going to do, I couldn't do it. I think I had, of all things I was teaching by this stage, I think I had a school camp on that I had to go to.
Always so starts with training and school camps.
Yeah, I know. So I wasn't able to do that. I'd be away on the Sunday. I think I was going to do Vienna, initially. And that would have been perfect because, you know, it's a sort of step down from the gold label races, but still super competitive. And then I was like, well, I'm still training for an April marathon. And this Brighton one came up, so I said, okay, I'll have a crack at it. And the course looked relatively flat. It wasn't flat in the end, but it looked flat. And the only issue would be, because it was right on the coast, was if there was any wind. And there happened to be wind on the day, unfortunately. So that didn't help my goals. But, yeah, then I said, all right, well, I'm going to go do this race. And the goal is to, you know, instead of just run a time trial, which I had been doing in my previous halves and full marathons, is to actually just compete in the race. And hopefully, as a result, my time's fast enough. And I went through in half pretty feeling all right. But again, the wheels came off at 25K and I crept to the line. And I was also a little bit annoyed with myself that I'd missed an opportunity again, and you know, go back to the drawing board with the tail between my legs, thinking, geez, what do I have to do to get a good marathon in me? So the last 10Ks I should have probably pulled out, but I just wanted to finish the marathon. You know, there was nothing wrong with me in terms of injury. It was just I was going too slow. So anyway.
And 2:24 that day, so it must have been a bit disheartening. And I know, just like a fan and kind of keeping track of the running, it was kind of like you disappeared for a while after that. And I remember not seeing a result from you until that City to Sea win in Melbourne in 2014.
Well, actually I did a whole bunch of had some really good European races. I think around the same time, I ran my 10K road PB, so I went under 29 minutes on the road in the Netherlands. I ran a 20K in the Netherlands as well, and ended up coming third in that one. And the guy who came second was Salisi Sahin, who was an Olympic silver medalist, and him and I were sprinting to the line that day. And I remember going, geez, like I've taken the silver medalist to the line. And so I knew I was in good shape. So I was having some good sort of shorter distance races. And then the next marathon I entered was Hamburg. But unfortunately, that was when the wheels really came off. Russell Desai Chin and I both got into that race to race Hamburg. And we're like, sweet, because I knew what shape he was in. I knew what kind of runner he is. And he knew exactly the same about me. So we're like, well, let's run together. We'll aim for sort of like a 2:15, 2:16 type thing. And if we're feeling good in the last 10K, we'll just, you know, head off and see you at the finish line type thing. And I got to 25K, and I felt this. We went down this little downhill section, and I felt this little twinge in my left Achilles. And I thought nothing of it. I just thought, whatever, you know, I'm just stretching it out a little bit, overstriding. And then came up again, and then it felt like even stronger, this twinge. And I'm like, shit, like if I keep this up, I'm going to rip my Achilles, like, in half. And, like, I wasn't sprinting or anything. I was a pretty midfoot strike runner as well. And I think I said to Russ, I said, mate, I'm done. You go. And he kept going up the road. And he was only like 10 seconds up the road. And I was just watching him. And I was sort of like favoring my right side, hoping that this thing in my Achilles would sort of just pass. Maybe it was just a little cramp or I don't know what it was. But it got worse and worse. And in the end, I stopped and walked from 28 to 30, hoping that I was like, I never not finish a race. Like I'm going to finish this thing. But in the end, I'd stopped my watch and everything like that. I wasn't racing for a time anymore. In the end, I actually couldn't put any pressure on my left side. It was that sore, it just flared up so bad. So I went to the 30K drink station, and they said there was a bus, like a sag wagon bus or whatever. So I sat in there and had a little cry about feeling sorry about myself until it finally took us back to the hotel. And that was basically the end of the beginning of the end in terms of my running career, because once it all settled down and things like that, about a week later I went and saw a surgeon, a sports doctor, and he gave me two options. He said, okay, so now that the inflammation's coming down, I can see what's going on, and you've got this tendinosis in your Achilles that, you know, unfortunately you haven't torn anything, which is great news, but we're basically going to have to go in there and clean up the Achilles, and you'll have to be in a moon boot for a little while, and then you have to rehab it and get the strength all back. And then hopefully you can be back running in to where you are now in about a year's time. And I think I just had my 30th birthday at that stage, and I'm like, geez, like I'm not getting any younger here. And, you know, I've been holding off, you know, hoping to make a national team, and, you know, I need to start earning some big cash. Like I was teaching and stuff like that, but I was working 0.8 or 80%.
Yeah.
I wasn't working full time and stuff like that. So little factors along the way. And then he said, and his parting comment in his very Swiss German way was like, and there's no guarantees, like I could open you up and do all the clean out and fix you all, close you up, and then it's still as bad as, or it might be a little bit less bad than what it is now. And I'm like, oh geez, that's a great guarantee. And then he goes, oh, and also because you're not a Swiss person, you're an Aussie, it's user pay, so you're going to have to pay out of pocket, which is like going to be 13 or 14 grand or something ridiculous at that stage. So I made the decision there and then, like, one, I can't afford it, two, it's too much of a risk, and three, there's no guarantees that I'm coming back to as good as I am. So I literally hung up the shoes then and there. I walked out of that that doctor's appointment and said, that'll do me. So I for a little while didn't do anything, and then for a little bit later I actually picked up an old road bike while I was still in Switzerland at this stage, and just did that for a little bit of fun, because, you know, you're at the foothills of all these amazing mountains. So I started riding hills and things like that, and it was weird because I was sitting on the bike and I'd get out of the saddle to climb this hill, no Achilles pain, nothing, and I was like, this is ridiculous. Like, is it in my head? Am I having some sort of a mental breakdown and I think that I'm injured? And I wouldn't have any pain on the bike. I could literally do anything. Swimming was okay as well. I could still go for an easy run, but if I backed up and did like two or three runs in a row, that's when it would flare back up. So this was probably 3 or 4 months further down the track once everything had settled. And I was like, well, I'm not going to be as competitive as I ever have been running 3 or 4 times a week. So that was when I decided that'll do me.
Was it a hard decision to make at the time? Sorry to interrupt. Like, you've been running since you were grade 5, grade 6, and it's kind of a big chunk of your life, and then all of a sudden it's gone.
Yeah, it was really tough because I define myself as a runner. Like, you know, you're Clint, and, you know, like, you're Clint, you're that runner. You know, you're an athlete sort of thing. I define myself as that first and foremost. And, you know, when that kind of stopped, it was forced upon me. It wasn't out of choice. It took a little while to sort of say, you know what, like, now what? Like, what's next? And luckily, I was working full time by that stage, so I threw myself into work and all those sort of things for the next year or so. And then the decision was made: will I stay in Switzerland or would I come back to Australia? And my contract at my work, my teaching job was up for, I was finishing. So the decision was, do I look for another job to stay in Europe or do I come back to Australia? And I sort of thought, well, I kind of came to Europe for the run-in, so maybe I'll come back to Australia. And at that stage, me and my Swiss missus had broken up, so there was no reason to stay there as well. So a few little life changes meant that I came back to Australia, which is a good thing. But I kind of, once I got back here, a lot of people said to me, and I remember talking to Sean Williams, who'd just moved from Sydney down to Melbourne to pick, start the Melbourne Pack group down here. And I remember him saying to me, he contacted me and said, hey, because his training group is in Edithvale, where I grew up. He's asking me about good training locations and stuff. And he's like, are you going to come back to do some running? And I said, oh, yeah, I might do. But still, I let it go for long enough that I was kind of at one of those points where I don't even know if I can run 3-minute K pace anymore. Like, what's that feel like? So I didn't actually think too much about the running. I bought myself a road bike when I got back here, and I thought, I'll just ride, you know, go to the gym, keep myself fit, you know, if I want to look after myself, and see how we go. And then in the end, I saw this City to Sea race, and I thought, you know what, I'm gonna see if I've still got it. So my missus, she moved back to Australia with me. I'm dating a Canadian, so she left her life to come to Australia to live.
Jeez, and you've dated a few different nationalities along the way as well, haven't you?
Yeah, like you get a map and you just throw a dart at it, and that's usually the way.
That's the strategy, is it? Yeah, right.
yeah. So she's moved to Australia with me, and she didn't really know. She knew that I was a runner, but she didn't really know, I guess, like she'd never really seen many of my results or many of my races. So I sort of said to her, hey, there's this City to Sea race coming up. It's in Melbourne. There's no travel. And she knew, she saw me when I had my dodgy Achilles and how frustrating it was for me, because I actually worked with Carrie. And she said, well, what about your Achilles? And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to roll the dice. And then I said, you know what else? And she goes, what's that? And I go, first prize is business class tickets to South America.
South America, yeah.
And Carrie's like, my missus, she's like, yep, let's do it. So I'm like, all right, let's go for a run. So she was on the bike, and I just said to her, let's just jog down to the beach from home. We were living in Elsternwick at the time. So that was like a little bit of a warm-up. And I said, and when we hit the beach, just go on the front, and I'm just going to yell to you to go quicker and quicker till I hit the mark, and then I'll tell you to hold it. So she's sort of basically motor pacing me on the bike. And I look down at my watch, and I'm hitting 250s, and I'm like, shit, like, this is good. Like, this is race pace. I don't have to go faster than this to try and win this thing. And I held it for like 3Ks or so, and then I bring it back down, and I finished, and I think I ended up doing about a 10K session. And Carrie said to me, she's like, what do you think? I'm like, well, yeah, look, my Achilles is going to be sore tomorrow because of what I've just done, but shit, I think I can hold that pace. So I think I did a couple more sessions like that. I did a couple of efforts around Albert Park, like I did a 10K time trial and tried to hold 3-minute pace and got pretty much on the mark. And I thought, well, as long as they hold 3-minute pace, I reckon I can be competitive. And I showed up on the day, and good old Nate Hardigan's there as well, and he's like, mate, I thought you were done, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, one more crack at it, one more. So him,
Nick Earl was third, I think,
Nick
that
Earl,
as well. Yeah,
Nick Earl, and actually a young McSewan was there as well. So there was the four of us rolled off, and they went out pretty quick, and I was like sub 3 minutes. I'm like, oh, geez, this could be tough. But then we settled down to about 3 minute K pace. And then there was a section through Elwood Park near MSAC. And I was like, well, I know I don't have the acceleration or finishing speed that I used to have because I haven't done any specific training. So I need to get rid of these boys. So I smashed myself. I think I did a kilometre basically eyes closed and held about 2:48 for it. And I thought, if these guys can hold it, then they deserve to win. If they don't, then I might be able to hold on to the win. And I knew I had about 4K to go by the end of this. I just buried myself for a kilometre and looked back and I had about a 10-second lead. And then I was like, all right, well, now it's up to them to catch me. So I just kind of kept looking back and I was fading like crazy. But I was also motivated by what the little prize pool was going to be at the end as well. And I made a little promise to the missus between the two of us. And so I crossed the line and the first person I saw was my missus on the other side and pointed straight to her and ran up to her and said, all right, do you want to go to Brazil? And then the next day I was in strife, like I was hobbling around and stuff like that. And I was like, you know what, like, I've proven that I can do it. That'll do me. I've come back to Australia and I've proven that I've still, you know, still got the legs. But I'm not going to put up with having to hobble around for 2 or 3 days afterwards with this dodgy Achilles. So we both decided at that stage that maybe more time on the bike and less running. Like nowadays, I can go for a 5K or a 10K run without an issue, but not at the old race pace like it used to be.
It's not a bad way to end it, though, is it? Like it's probably justifies the whole career and a good way to end on a high rather than that that poor result in the marathon.
That's exactly. I think
you deserve that,
myself,
yeah,
as well. Because I didn't want my lasting memory of running to be me walking towards the sag wagon in Hamburg with my head slung low. So I wanted to finish with with a positive feeling about the sport of running, which has given me so much over the years. So that was one of the main motivators as well, to at least go for one more time. And I reckon I've left it for too long now that I could I don't know if I'd ever be able to get back to the 3 minute sort of pace or sub 3 minute pace, but I might have let it go for a little bit too long. So I knew that it was a ticking clock as well.
Yeah, and Clint, you're a pro cyclist now, is that right? I haven't been keeping track of your career, but that's what people are telling me.
Nah, mate. Look, I race in the masters category. Anything over 30 is considered masters in cycling terms. And you know, there's a whole bunch of young boys trying to make pro teams that they can go to Europe and be on TV in the Tour de France and stuff. And that's definitely not what my goals are, but masters racing, you have a few guys that are former pros that have come back and started families and stuff like that and working full time, and so it's still competitive enough that I get my competitive juices flowing on a regular occurrence, and gives me something to focus on, because I think if I didn't compete in something, I'd probably compete in other ways detrimental. So I kind of need a regular stimulus of competition, and this sort of cycling for me has given me that. And I go to races nowadays under the radar, I guess, like nobody knows who I am or previous results and stuff, because when you show up at a running race like Bernie 10 or whatever, the announcer calls out your name and then gives everybody in the crowd as well as the people on the start line a rundown of your results. Whereas you show up at a cycling race and you know, you're just one of, 50 guys on the line in Lycra, and you can kind of go under the radar a little bit. And the first few races I did, I kind of jumped out and had some decent results. And I think runners make good cyclists, especially good climbers. And there's some good examples of that, especially in the Melbourne scene as well. So I sort of found that I've been able to use my cardio engine, but in a different sport. So it's been lots of fun, and you learn all the time, like tactically cycling, sitting in the draft and all that stuff, or learning how to climb a hill and where to put the efforts in and how to go into the red, recover and go into the red again. Whereas as a runner, as I'm sure you guys and all the listeners know, once you go into the red and you go lactic, you're generally not coming back from that. Whereas cycling, you can kind of bury yourself, and then sort of, if you get a sit on somebody, you can recover. You only need 30 seconds or a minute, and then you can recover and kind of go again. So learning the craft of a new sport has been interesting as well, definitely. Yeah.
And you're still a fan of the athletics and road races? Like, you pay attention, and like, especially those guys you spoke about who are lined up for a marathon at the Com Games next weekend. Like, they're your ex-competitors.
Yeah, definitely. And look, I'm super chuffed to see that these guys are still out there and still having excellent results. And so, yeah, I'll definitely have the Com Games tuned in. And I went out to Zatopek, which was my first track meet that I've been to since being on the other side of the fence, on the competitor side of the fence. So I went to Zatopek this year. And look, I probably wouldn't show up to the AV races or anything like that, but I am still doing some running coaching as well. So I've got a couple of athletes racing Geelong Half this weekend. So at various levels. So still very much involved with running and interested in running, just not doing it myself personally as much as I used to.
Yeah, I'm interested in your opinion of the state of athletics in Australia, especially like when Julian went to Zatopek as well when it was on, and he came away a bit disappointed, like not so much in the athletes, but just the atmosphere and how it kind of lacked a bit of up and aboutness, I guess. Like, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, look, it's funny because I went there expecting a bit of Nitro Athletics action, you know, like music pumping and big crowds and all that sort of stuff. And I took my now wife and we were there, and I was like, we stayed till the end because we wanted to watch 10K, but we didn't get there right at the start because we were like, this is like, there was no atmosphere. It was a little bit dull. There was a lot of downtime as well. Like, I don't know, in this current age of sport, especially like I'm in the background as we're talking now, there's the triathlon and they're doing some sort of weird sprint relay thing with boys and girls and stuff like that. And you know, there's so many sports nowadays that are embracing the change of, you know, of evolution of like 2020 cricket and stuff like that. And athletics is just still stuck in its old traditional ways of, you know, we'll do a race and then we'll present the trophy or the medal or whatever it is, and then we'll do another race. And it's just a lot of downtime, and you know, kids don't want to go and see that, like, and parents don't want to drag their kids along to see something where the kids get bored and they start being nuisances and stuff like that. And I was surprised that even Athletics Australia or Athletics Victoria didn't contact all, like, I work at a school and I got no contact to say, oh, here's 20 free tickets to give out to your kids, to get kids along. And of course, and then they're going to bring their parents and stuff like that. Like, little things like that would just help build the atmosphere a little bit. You get a bunch of kids who look out there and they see athletes that they're keen on, and then they bring their fee-paying parents as well. Like, the parents are going to have to come in and pay the entry fee and stuff like that. So they still get in their ticket sales there and stuff like that. So I think it's a little bit old school and a little bit stuck in their ways, and they need a little bit of a rock. And maybe just look to some of the other sports, the similar sports like cycling do a lot of criteriums now, which only last an hour, and they go around Albert Park and there's action happening, and triathlon has really embraced it. Not that I'm a triathlete, but you can see that those Weet-Bix triathlons for the little kids and stuff like that at St Kilda on a Sunday morning and stuff. So they've obviously embraced getting the family atmosphere happening as well, but athletics hasn't really gotten there yet.
Yeah, it's all interesting points. It's going to be interesting to see where it all goes in the next 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, look, that Nitro Athletics, I tuned in and watched a little bit of it. Maybe that was a little bit too extreme, but surely there's something in the middle where you can have all your events, but just, I don't know why you have to have so many breaks in between. Mm. You should have, you know, the men's 800, and you should have the women lined up ready to go. So as soon as the men have crossed the line, the gun's going for the next race. And then in the middle, you've got your high jump happening, and then you've got a throwing event happening at the other end. Like, we run, as a school teacher, we run sports events like house athletics and inter-school sports, and we just stack the carnival, stack the program so we can get in and out as quickly as we can, because we've got a limp. We had to book the athletics oval, and but we've got buses booked, and we've got a limited amount of time that we've been allocated. So, you know, we're like, we have to just fire through things, and we've got, you know, the A race lined up and the B race standing behind them, ready to jump in literally as the last kid crosses the line. So I don't know why athletics can't do something similar like that. Like,
yeah, I've been there as well. I'm a school teacher as well, and it's yeah, exactly the same. And then you got the C and the D, and you're yelling at people to get the E ready, and it just works like clockwork.
Yeah, exactly, and that's the way it needs to be. And yeah, I don't know. Like, I was a little bit before the whole social media age, but there probably should be a bit more promotion of the sport, and even profiles of the athletes. Like, these people are supposed to be what the kids are looking up to, and they should be household names. Like, Sally Pearson's a household name, but we've got people out there who, I don't know, like, maybe they're not winning gold medals all the time and stuff like that, but bloody hell, they're running quick and they're throwing far and they're jumping high. So they should be the role models that we're attracting young kids to want to do. Otherwise, they're just going to pick different sports like triathlon, like footy. You know, we lost a lot of good athletes to footy because they know that they can actually make a living out of it. And I mentioned back in the day when I was running, like, I still had to hold down a full time job to pay the rent and put food on the table, because the whole institutes of sports weren't supporting people that were making national teams and stuff like that. And it's just a little bit of a shame that that the pathways for these juniors transitioning into seniors, and then once you're in seniors and you're a national team, you shouldn't have to be making life sacrifices just so you can try and make an Olympic team. Like, I know guys that missed out on education because they wanted to make an Olympics, and they may have their Olympic rings tattooed on their shoulder or something like that, but they had to go back to school to get a qualification so they can now put food on the table. And I don't know, there's the whole system needs a little bit of an overhaul, I think.
Yeah, it's a bit broken, I think, and yeah, you've made up some good points, but I reckon we could both sit here and talk about it all day. But I've taken up so much of your time already, and grateful for that, and grateful for you sharing your journey with the listeners today. And yeah, thanks again for joining the Inside Running podcast.
No worries, guys, and excellent work what you're doing. Again, promoting the sport and getting some lesser-known names like my own out there, so people sort of learn that it's not only about the elite people that you see on TV. It's sometimes the grinders behind the scenes, and that's what makes the sport of athletics and the sport of distance running so great. And that's one of the reasons I've still got some of my best mates, guys that I used to train with and race against and stuff like that. And yeah, it's been great.
Yeah, cheers, Clint.
Doesn't matter if it don't